my colleagues that are driving over from Portland and they're on their way to sort out the teaming space and we'll get started.
Judge Broad, District 56, which is Final Falls and Southern Pine County.
I'm State Representative Chuck Burley, House District 54, and I want to welcome all of you to Bend, which is my district, and I'm here for this committee meeting here.
I'm Terry Meyer, and I represent House District 12.
I'm Representative Cliff Benz. I'm just here by invitation of the chair, and I'm very happy to join the group.
Thanks for joining us, and Representative Cannon represents the district in Portland. Southeast Portland, Representative Reed is the Beaverton area, and they should be here shortly. So I wanted to welcome everybody today and thank our folks for coming who will be testifying. The theme of today's hearing is twofold. First, on renewable energy. Many of you know we passed the renewable portfolio standard that set goal for 25% renewable energy by 2025 last session. And so we're going to be provided with an update from both the Public Utility Commission and the Department of Energy this morning, along with folks who've been working in the field at the grassroots level developing renewable energy sources. We're going to provide an update today on that. And then the second part of the hearing will focus on water. And you know, we had a water forum here in Bend yesterday and appreciate that my colleagues, Representative Benz and Burley, were there as well. And we'll have some updates on that and we'll hear on water quality issues from the Department of Environmental Quality, and then updates on water conservation in Central Oregon area. So it's going to be an action-packed agenda. We will have time for public testimony at the end, and the goal is to finish here at noon. And the second part of today's hearing is a field tour, so we can actually see some on-the-ground projects that have been funded through the River Monitoring Enhancement Board and River Conservancy, and that'll be the Little Sisters area in the second part. And you're always welcome to join us if you need details on that. Check in with our committee administrator. So with that, I want to welcome Mr. Breyer. And we also have Representative Parker on the phone. Representative Parker, do you want to introduce yourself as well? Are you there?
I am. Please.
Okay.
Let me briefly introduce myself. Thank you for including me. I am a new member of the House, just sworn in mid-June, and am from Beaverton and Washington County. Not on the committee, of course, but very interested in the matter being covered.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us today, and welcome. And feel free to ask questions. Just chime in, and we appreciate you calling in.
Thank you very much.
So with that, I'd like to welcome the first panel that's going to provide an update on the renewable portfolio standard of business energy and renewable energy tax credits. We have Lee Beyer, who is chair of the Public Utility Commission. And this is an official panel, isn't it? Chair. And Mike Rainey, who is director of the Oregon Department of Energy. So welcome, gentlemen, and thank you for coming over.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this morning, give you a little update on what we've been doing to implement your legislation, which is Senate Bill 838.
And I don't know if you might have to speak a little bit more to the mic.
How's that? Is it working?
Hearing that.
All right. What I'd like to do is just touch very quickly on the RPS and also just a little tad on the energy efficiency, which was also a piece of that bill. And I know that you have later in the agenda a report from the Energy Trust of Oregon, which I assume will go into a little bit more detail on some of that since they've implemented it. So I'll go ahead and get started. Maybe. I always like to start out with something a little humorous, and I was thinking that to remind everybody that our perspective at the commission is from the ratepayers' perspective, and this one, it's kind of funny, those in the back if you can't see it, but essentially the tagline here is tonight's workshop, alternative energy, and Frank and Ernie are talking to each other and essentially saying, wind and solar are fine, but nothing beats an extension cord plugged into your neighbor's outlet.
We're just trying to shift it since we all have paper copies so people in the audience can see. So just keep them very low. Maybe over the logistics here.
All right. Under the law that you passed last session, Oregon utilities must meet a percentage of their retail electricity loads with renewable resources. And it really gets down to the major impact is on two of our investor-owned utilities, PG and Pacific Core, and also Eugene Water and Electric Board, which is our largest consumer-owned utility in the state. And those goals are, overall, it's to hit 25% of the electric load by 2025 from renewable resources. And the interim targets start in 2011. That's 5%, 15% by 2015, and 20% by 2020. There are other standards for the other utilities, but basically they start later in the game, as you showed up down there. The one issue with for the smaller utilities, they have a little more leeway in getting there with the one proviso that if they decide to build a coal-fired plant, it puts them in the game with the three bigger utilities right away.
Mr. Breyer, can you just define other utilities for folks in the audience?
Other utilities may be the smaller public utility districts, co-ops, which are private. PUDs are public agencies. Co-ops are private consumer-owned corporations. And municipalities, there's a small number of municipalities in the state, Eugene, Springfield, Melton Free Water, Forest Grove, Brain, Ashland, that run their own utility as part of that operation. For the most part, what's probably, in terms of people may wonder why there's a distinction, if you look at the smaller utilities, they get almost all of their power from Bonneville Power Administration, which is all pretty much hydro and a little bit of nuclear power. So they pretty much are fully renewable generation load at this point. All right, so what are the eligible resources that qualify? They really fall into a number of categories. The two biggest ones are wind and solar. That's mostly what we're paying attention on, but there's also geothermal, biomass, wave, tidal, ocean thermal, and some efficiency improvements to existing hydro plants. Then there's also hydrogen. Anything that produces hydrogen would qualify also under your law. Utilities can comply with the law in four different ways. They can build a new generating facility or continue using one that they have. They can buy power from an independent generator. They can buy what's called renewable energy certificates, and that's a unit of power. Or they can make alternative compliance payments if they have trouble meeting that. The compliance payment essentially is they would pay, in essence, kind of a penalty, but the penalty would be retained by them, and they would have to use that money to develop renewables to, in essence, come in compliance with the law later on down the road, is the intent there. There is a cost cap that was part of the legislation, and essentially what it said is, what you said, was that if the cost of compliance would be greater than 4% of an alternative generating source, there's an off-ramp form there. The other part, you allowed utilities to get timely recovery of prudent purchases and renewable standards. That's a little different than what we normally do with the rate case. Usually there's a gap in there. With this, they can come in. As soon as they're done, they can come in and ask to have it put in rates, and we're actually going through the first phases of that now with both Pacific and PGE. And the other piece is that the utilities have to submit to the commission implementation plan. So they have to give us a plan that would say, how are we going to meet those goals in that process now? I would just note overall that both utilities are on track to meet the first two goals, the near-term goals, the 15%, and 5% and 15%. Currently, PGE is about 9%. They will be by that. They'll exceed, how do I say it better? They're about 10% of the load, so they're about double. They will be about double where they're required to be. 2015, they've got the resources bought to get there. The plans are in place, so there's no question that they will make the 2015 deadlines. This gives you a sense of where they're doing. These are the projects that are currently underway for PG. It's almost all wind, and so you've got a mix up there, the Van Sickle and Klondike. Bigelow Canyon is the newest one coming online. They're all pretty much in Unitil and Sherman County for PGE. Civic Corps, likewise, is pretty much on target to meet the 2011 plan. What we know they have under contract right now is not quite at 15%, but in discussions with them, there's no doubt they will meet the 15% by 2015. This is a little different view on theirs. The projects, a couple of them are up in Washington State, some in Oregon. The future projects that are under consideration by Pacific Corps right now are primarily going to be in the Wyoming area. And one of the things I think that's interesting is the same terminal, give you the description, same terminal that you would, same windmill that you would put on the Columbia River with the wind activity there. Would generate electricity about 2%, 2 cents a kilowatt hour more expensive than if you did it in Wyoming. And it's really the factor of the wind. And one of the things utilities are trying to balance out is the wind in different locations peaks at different times and trying to get a balance in that. So an important factor for both of these as we get to the higher end of these things is transmission. And we're looking at a number of transmission improvement projects that will improve the capacity of all the Northwest utilities to move power around and better balance that load, which, you know, happens at different times. So,
what do you do with it?
Beyond the wind, though, there are other things that we're doing here, and a lot of this is we're doing through the Energy Trust and with the help of the Department of Energy. We do have some biomass projects that are underway. 18 megawatts, you see up there. Pacific Four has done some additional things on cogeneration with existing mills. Some dairy and landfill activity. There's a number of small cities, a number of cities that we're working with the capturing of landfill gas and stuff coming up their sanitary sewers, trying to deal with that. Small pieces and Warm Springs in this area, I think the Riverside and Burley's familiar with, they're trying to do a project with that. Solar, they've done more than 1,000 projects across the state.
Excuse me.
Just to remind everybody,
yeah, that's
the
last time we're doing that.
Thank you for that reminder. And your BlackBerry, because it interferes with our recording.
That's always embarrassing. It's twice this happened to me. Down. I thought I had it turned off. Anyway, there are other geothermal. There's an interesting one in this area here, the Newberry Crater. You know, the Department of Energy has been working with that for a long time. That's a project that's a little bit south of here. It's likely to happen now. Unfortunately, the power is under contract to Pacific Gas and Electric in California. One of the issues we're going to deal with is that all of the northwestern states pretty much have adopted RPS, and so it's a battle to who can get to the resource first. So, a little bit of hydro. PG's done some expansions of the Round Butte project, which is over here in the Pineville area, and both of them are looking at upgrades to existing hydro facilities. This is just, it's kind of hard to see, but I thought you'd be interested just to give you a sense of the wind projects. And this one, they're all wind, that have filed in the Bonneville queue to be able to connect to the thing. So this is an example of what's out there in terms of the developers wanting to bring the project on. It's just kind of a sense of what's out there. A lot of it. Important point is that a lot of those are being developed in Oregon, but they're not coming to Oregon. They're going to Washington State or they're going to California.
Can you go back to that slide?
I can.
Question is, can you explain to the committee how the transmission process connection with EPA works? In other words, somebody puts in for one project, and then they have to get in the queue with EPA, how the funding for that works, and what role the state plays.
If there's existing capacity, they just have to get permission to connect to the line and get on the system, and then they have to pay transmission costs, which is a standard contract. Wherever you come from, you're going to pay for the cost of moving the power. If you're a new project coming in and there's an area like we're seeing in the northern part of the gorge where there isn't an adequate capacity, what Bonneville has done, and frankly what Idaho Power and Pacific are doing now, they're looking at new transmissions, they're doing in essence a subscription process where they're essentially going out in an RFP-like process and saying, we're thinking of building this line, who will commit to signing up to this line to see if there's enough capacity to do that. And they have to commit. In Bonneville's case, if they get in the queue and they want to go forward, they have to put down the down payment. I believe it's $6 million fee that they have to put down deposit. One of the issues in the past that Bonneville has faced with is the fact that people would all say, we want to hook up, but there was no commitment, and they would get into the process, and they weren't sure whether they had the financing to go forward. So they're trying to ask you, like, if you're buying a home, it's the earnest money kind of deal. The issue is to go forward, though. To meet the RPS goals that we have on the table now, if we're looking primarily at wind, there is not adequate transmission capacity to do all of that. The other side of that one is we do have transmission plans that are moving through the process that will get us to a place where we can do that.
Chairman Beyer, there was an article in the Oregonian over the summer about a weekend where we had a lot of wind, and apparently the EPA was trying to get a hold of the wind folks and get them to scale back so that they didn't have to spill more water, which was contrary to this hydro-op plan. What are we doing, or what are the feds doing, so that we can try to avoid those problems in the future?
In that particular case, they probably couldn't have avoided that. The issue was you were at the high flow period of time in the river, and you also happened to be at a high wind period at that period of time. And from the biological side, there's only so much water they can spill over the dams without over-oxygenating the water and killing the fish. So they hit that point where I'm being a little confusing here. When the wind is blowing, you want to take as much of that generation power as you can. It's important both because it's cheap, and secondly, the wind developers, part of the financing is that they get the tax credit based on how much power they're generating, so they need to get it in as much as they can. The downside of that is that you're asking BPA, which is doing what we call integrating, is they're making it all work. There's only so much. They back off their water on that. They don't sell that, and they get a payment on that. And there's only so much of that they can do at any given at these peak times. I think the answer to that one is that what we learned is that they need better coordination between the wind operators and the dam operators. And I think they've addressed that. That was the first gotcha that they ran into. Doing this merger of renewables and the standard thermal and hydro system requires a lot more coordination than the operators are used to. They're going to learn that. They're going to get there. It's just there's a lot of learning to do. I think we'll figure out how to do that as we go along. This is just, I at the governor's forum, some of you may have seen this. I just thought this was really interesting. You probably see it better in your packet. This is a diagram, a map, if you will, that was put together by the Renewable Northwest, which they're focusing on that, and gives you a sense of both the potential and the projects that are out there of all different scales that they're looking at. And I guess the image that struck me as I'm looking at this is it shows you that there's a lot of potential out there. So we're getting there. I think that's good. At the end of that, one of the points that I just wanted to make sure that you were understanding is we're making really good progress on getting the renewables in. And in our shop at the PUC, we don't see any trouble at all at getting to the 2015 targets. There's some cost impacts with that. Some of the things we're seeing, for example, is that the cost of wind turbines have gone up almost 2 to 3 times the cost of 2 years ago. And a lot of that's just a result of, all of the legislators across the United States got excited at the same time and hit the same targets, and the aspirations were exceeding the manufacturing capacity at this time. But the market prices are going up. That and the fact that what's happening globally with the cost of commodities, steel, cement, those kinds of things, is just all construction projects are getting more expensive. So it's pushing up there. There's the issue that's going with that. Good news on that, some of the prices, and I think you'll hear from the solar people, some of that is coming down. on that side of the issue. We're starting to see more in the Southwest some larger utility scale, or what we call central station kinds of solar projects to matching with the photovoltaic projects and residences. So I think there's a good mix going there. The question for not politicians or policymakers, the question for the utility operators is when you get above 15%, the engineers tell me it gets more difficult to get all that merged together. And I remember setting that I'm on the reliability board of directors for the Western Interconnection. It's all the Western states, Canada, Western Canada, and Mexico. And listening to the engineers, they're sort of, no one's off of, we got to do this. Everybody thinks this is a really good idea. The questions from the engineering perspective is, we're going to do this. We don't know how we're going to do this. But we're going to figure it out, and we're hoping that with some advances in technology and additional learned information that they will be able to do it. But it's not an easy thing to do, and with some of that, I would suggest that there, from the policy side, there needs to be a little bit of patience to get in there. So it's an emergency, but temper that a little bit with some patience. Other two things I'm going to just leave you with, because I thought it was interesting, is Gail Hill of the Oregonian did a really nice story on solar, what it takes to make residential solar going. And I thought that was fascinating, and I want to make sure that you had a chance to see that if you haven't before. It's a big investment. We're putting a lot of money into that, and I think that what we hope is that will bring the costs down over time, but it gives you a good example. The other piece is just to let you know what the Energy Trust is doing, and I'm not going to steal Fred's Gordon's thunder on this one. I just had gotten this from a brief report. From the Commission's perspective, from the ratepayer perspective, getting towards the climate change goals and all that, I like to say that the first brick in the wall is energy efficiency. We've got to use what we can get more efficiently, and that's the investment that the legislature has made, or actually I should say the ratepayers have made. We've got a public purpose charge of 3%. Two-thirds of that goes to investments in energy efficiency. A third of that goes to developing the renewables, sort of seeding the renewable effort. Last session, as part of the RPS bill, you added to that the ability for utilities to come to the commission and propose plans to increase that amount by up to 1.5% more. So where we're at is about 4.3%. Both of them have come to us, and it's essentially recovering that portion of the opportunity out there that is not being met under the 3% charge. So I think we're making some really good progress. There's a lot more things we can do, and you're going to hear a lot more about that in the next session, next legislative session, as well as I think we'll hear some this morning. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm available to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Any questions before we move on to the Department of Energy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chairman Meyer, you've mentioned the alternative compliance payments. Have there been any of those yet?
No, we're not at that. We're not at the point where those are coming to play yet.
And follow up. Yeah, it's a little rusty. Chairman Meyer, you've mentioned that, you know, there's no real foreseeable problems with meeting the 2015 targets. But, you know, one of the things, especially since most of the renewables that are being developed are wind, and we know wind is not a firm power. So the question is, given the firm power load that we have now, the base load that we have now in place, how long do we have before utilities are going to have to look at the constructive new thermal or some other type of firm power to back up to go beyond the 2015 targets?
We're actually doing that right now.
They're doing it already.
In the least cost plans, and the primary resource behind that is natural gas. Natural gas turbines have a couple of advantages. One, in terms of different technologies, are the cheapest capital costs to bring online. The downside is the fuel cost. But from an operational standpoint, they have the ability to go from black to running full steam in a short period of time. So they're a good backup for that. But again, the design idea is that you would not run them when you had the wind or solar available running the backup. I guess the cost might be the question is, from a ratepayer perspective or rate perspective, how many of those do you have to build? And you're kind of doubling, not doubling, but you're adding to the initial capital cost because you're doing the backup. hopefully we'll be able to figure out a better way, get a better blend of wind resources, so the simplistic way is to hope the wind is blowing someplace. Then you get in the hundreds of humidity. And we have some of that. Some of the stuff I should mention. Most of the stuff in the gorge is winter peaking, heaviest blows at nighttime. Some of the stuff we've seen in Representative Ben's district, I know Project he's working on, is a summer peaking. And we're starting to, we have projects identified in the southern portion of the state that are something that are the opposite of the summertime. So there is some opportunities there, and certainly if you look broader in the region, if you look to Montana, eastern Montana, Wyoming, there's a better distribution of resources, a better balancing, I should say. But we won't know until we get to those higher levels.
You may have mentioned this already, but can you give us an idea of the impact on ratepayer of this alternative approach? Can you give us a general cost that the ratepayers are now shouldering as a result of this alternative activity?
Madam Chair, Representative, I really wouldn't want to say that off the top of my head. I can, and I will get that back to you. I don't know if that it's more, but I don't think at this point it's substantial.
Chairman Beyer, in Senate Bill 838, there was a 4% cost cap. There seems to be some confusion about exactly what that cost cap is and when it applies. My understanding, when we marked up this bill, that the cost cap was 4% of the annualized revenue that your commission projects for these utilities. And it was also my understanding that that was in every year, not just 2011 or 2015 or 2025, but every year. And furthermore, I think the record will show pretty clearly that that's a cost cap that limits how much the utility has to spend on complying, but it's not a cap on the ratepayer's increase. Now, is my understanding that correct?
Say it in a different way. We understand that the intent is that the rates would not go up more than 4% of what they would otherwise. The confusing piece about that is that you've got load increases, so you're doing a comparison to the cost of the additional renewable generation and that impact on rates compared to an alternative, and the alternative is basically gas. That would be the alternative market that we're comparing it to. So it's kind of a moving target, and we do that annually. We look at that annually.
So, when you say annually, you're saying that that cost cap does apply each year, 2008, 2009, 2010. It's not just 11, 15, and 25.
Madam Chair, Representative, I understand that we're early in the game trying to do this. The best time to do that is during the resource planning, or at least cost planning period, when you're looking at that. We have a process that we just put in the administrative rule to take a look at that. And we're making the best stab at it we can to try and keep that balance there. But we're really not far enough into the process now to see what's going to be done.
Of the Department of Energy, Oregon Department of Energy, and then we'll transition into an overview. We'll hear from other folks about the specific elements of the portfolio standard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. I'm Mike Graney, Director of the Department of Energy, and with Chair's permission, discussed with Beth, what I'd like to do is follow-ups, transition between Lee's comments and the panel behind me, talk a little more detail about the renewable energy development that's occurring, and then talk more specifically on the tax credits that you've asked for. First of all, as a result of the legislation we passed, both the RPS legislation, the increases in the tax credits, and also the biofuels legislation, which has impacts on biomass energy as well as biofuels, there has been significant development of renewable energy in the last few years. This is a result of legislation both in 2007, but also changes you made in 2005 for our incentives. It's very important because Oregonians spend over $12 billion a year in energy, just in our state. Our state's taxpayers and ratepayers. That's double what it was just 4 years ago, and our energy use has not doubled. It's resulted in huge increases in oil, natural gas, and other energy sources. Our sources of electricity in the past have been about 40% hydro, as people would expect, but also 40% coal. Many people don't realize that. Most of the coal comes from power plants in the mountain states. The renewable portfolio standard will change this significantly so that virtually all of Oregon's load growth for electricity would come from renewable energy by meeting that 25% standard by the year 2025. So it's very significant, and it's part of the package, again, of the other legislation that you passed to make that transition occur. On the transportation side, virtually all of our fuel has been oil for our vehicles. So, again, that's contributed significantly to that $12 billion cost. I mentioned briefly some of the developments that are occurring. First, in wind energy, there's four significant areas of wind energy development just south of the Dalles and Biggs Junction. Is where Bigelow Canyon and Klondike are, that Lee mentioned. South of Arlington is another significant area. Shepherd's Flat project that was just approved by our Siting Council a couple of weeks ago. It's the largest wind power plant in the world, not just in the country, but in the world, with 900 megawatts. Been significant development in the Boardman area, and also in La Grande as well, in La Grande area. So and now we're also seeing significant developments south in the Kearney County Burns area. This gives you a sense of the rate of increase of wind energy development the last 3 years especially. We've seen significant additions to our capacity. This is a list of the operating energy facilities right now, 800 megawatts are operating. By comparison, a natural gas power plant puts out about 300 megawatts of energy. So this is significant, even taking into account the variability and capacity factors for wind energy. This shows wind energy facilities that are under construction and will be completed soon, most of these before the end of this year, in order to qualify for the federal production tax credit, another 900 megawatts capacity. Our Siting Council, Energy Facilities Siting Council, approved the large power plants. County governments approved the small ones. Over 2,000 megawatts have been approved and are beginning construction, but they will be online within a couple of years. And another 850 megawatts there are currently under review. So it's a significant amount of wind energy.
Can you just, for the committee, I'm not sure we've discussed this before, about the threshold of which projects go to the facility Siting Council versus to the county, and a little bit of background on that legislative history?
Yes. In general, the threshold for energy facilities is 25 megawatts for most energy facilities and 35 megawatts for renewable energy. It means if it's over that, it goes to the Siting Council because of large statewide impacts and significance. It's under that, it's a county permit. For wind energy, the number translates into 105 megawatts because of the capacity discount, because 105 megawatts of capacity gets you about 35 megawatts of electricity generation because of the variability of wind that he mentioned. And the siting process, I think given the number of projects, has gone well. Our statute directs us to approve renewable energy facilities within 9 months, and in almost every case, The Siting Council has approved those in less than that after the application was completed. In some cases, as few as 4 or 5 months. All of those projects have gone through without any citizen opposition, environmental opposition. We've only have one project that has significant opposition, and it's a smaller project, actually, and it's near the Columbia River Gorge. It's outside the Dalles. It's outside the Columbia River Scenic Area, but it's near it, and it's potentially visible from there. That will be a very controversial project, and I don't know if that will conclude. But these others have gone through, for the most part, very smoothly compared to other energy facilities that we've had to deal with in the past.
And without getting into too much detail here, because unfortunately it's really limited, what I'm going to ask you to do to follow up with the committee is if you can do a side-by-side comparison of what are the criteria that the Facility Siting Council uses for approving these projects, and I feel like it's somewhat coming on the project location in general. Side by side with if it's under, for instance, for a wind project under the 105 megawatt threshold, and what the typical county would be processed with involved. I think that would be helpful for the community.
Sure. I'd be glad to, Madam Chair, and I'll get more information for you on that. In general, though, in our statewide siting council process, we work closely with the counties and ask for their criteria and we'll incorporate those in our process because we have a centralized process. And then where the county itself is making the decision, most of the counties have approached us to ask for guidance on criteria. So they're trying to make that as uniform as possible, recognizing their county's independence. Let me add, too, that Oregon is currently in the top 10 states in the country in wind energy, and with these additions, we'll be in the top 5 and perhaps in the top 3, following Texas and California ahead of us. Let me turn to geothermal energy. In the past, most geothermal energy use in the state was for space and hot water heating. We did not have the hot temperatures you need for power generation. The technology has improved both in terms of finding hotter resources, and the technology has improved in terms of being able to use lower temperature water for power generation. So we have 4 major areas under active consideration by developers. Neal Hot Springs near Vail in Ontario, the Warner Valley, which is just east of Lakeview, Newberry Crater that was mentioned just south of here, and Klamath Falls. I mentioned each of those briefly. The Neal Hot Springs has potential for 26 megawatts of power. It's a very promising resource, and active drilling is underway, and hopefully development within the next couple of years. Pump Geyser in Warner Valley near Lakeview, that geothermal company estimates 40 to 60 megawatts of energy there, also in the same time frame. Davenport Power at Newberry Crater is looking at a larger power plant of up to 120 megawatts in stages. And Klamath Falls, Oregon Institute of Technology, which has traditionally been heated entirely with geothermal hot water, as have 400 other buildings in Klamath Falls, is now looking to develop a 1.2 megawatt power plant that would fuel the entire campus, all its energy needs. They're also looking at another 10 megawatts south of town for generating electricity. So there's some significant geothermal development underway. Very promising in the next couple of years. Let me turn to biomass energy. There are 78 biomass energy facilities of all types throughout the state. And most of that energy is used by industry, by the forest products industry. And we capture waste heat using electricity for generation. We have 25 facilities that are generating electricity, over 300 megawatts. Again, at the size of a natural gas power plant. It's enough for 170,000 homes, so this is a significant source of our energy supply. Some recently completed projects include an expansion of biomass 1 in Southern Oregon, Douglas County, Tolomac Lumber, the Ferris Lumber project up at the San Diego Canyon have all gone forward. So in all, it's been about a 10% increase in our biomass electricity energy supply. We also have some biogas projects, gas from landfills that then is used for electricity production, again, another 20 megawatts or so. And there are promising additional projects out there. Let me turn to solar energy. We've seen this will tie in directly to the tax credits also. We've seen significant increase in solar energy use. We'll hear more from reference in the other panels, but especially in photovoltaics, we're seeing a 35% growth per year in residential tax credits. And that 2008 number is just the first 2 months, and we're on pace now to exceed the numbers in 2007. We're seeing a similar increase in business energy use of solar in terms of the numbers of increases. Again, the 2008 number was early in the year. We're on pace to exceed that in terms of numbers, but also what we're seeing is much larger systems. So that's the 4 to 8-fold increase in installed capacity. The size of these systems is getting much larger. Large commercial applications, kettle chips, for example, in Salem, about 30% of their energy load is met from solar energy, PV and direct use of solar. Number of other commercial applications are occurring throughout the state that are of that size or even larger. We also now have significant, through the tax credits, solar manufacturing facilities. You hear from one of them today, PV Powered, which is located here in Bend, makes converters that for a number of the different solar manufacturing companies. These companies, like Solex, Solar World, Exxon, Spectralot, which is an Intel spinoff, and most recently ExxonX, make different aspects of wafers, ingots, and other aspects of solar components. These are high-tech firms. The technology works directly off the high-tech computer industry work. They bring high-paying jobs, hundreds of jobs. They can use the high-tech trained workers we have here. In fact, Solar World, which was the most recent one that's in terms of large-scale production, held a jobs fair to interview people at the Hynex facility, which is down in Eugene, and try to help the people there who are facing unemployment. So there could be some benefits in terms of workers who are here facing job difficulties being able to transition easily into solar manufacturing. We have active discussions going on with about half a dozen other companies. I think we're very close to announcing two more that will be located in Oregon. And most of these are actually not in direct competition with each other, but make different aspects of the phases that you need to have solar panels.
Could you clarify that
on the
far right? Is that the state's investment?
No, that's the company's investment. That is not the tax credit amount, although they are using the tax credit. And under the 2008 companies you mentioned that have not received a tax credit if they have applications pending, the special session increased the tax credit for solar manufacturing facilities up to a $20 million credit from $10 million, but it requires, in order to receive that credit, the state to undertake an economic review of the viability of the company, impose expectations in terms of job creation, other economic benefits, and it's a contract that, with what are called clawback provisions, if those are not met, the state can reclaim the tax credit. So it's a new economic development.
And I realize it's going to it would be good to get that information for you as well as you're keeping track of the state investments and the terms of the job creation is going to be in the state.
And I'll get into that a little more in a moment to discuss with you. Here's a list now. We have over 60 companies actively involved in solar energy. Not only... Not only direct manufacturing and distributors, but also and contractors and installers, but also design professionals who make a fortune in the work of solar energy. So this is stimulated economic development in the area. You mentioned briefly small hydro. Generally, we talk about small hydro as 20 megawatts or less, frequently 10 megawatts or less. Although they're not always that visible, they've been significant. This is throughout the last 20 years, we've had 31 projects receive over $100 million in energy loans from the department for producing electricity. Another 28 projects received $26 million in business tax credits. And in 2007, you increased the business tax credit from size of hydro from 1 megawatt to 10 megawatts. So we've been contacted by developers since then. We expect more small hydro. A USDOE study from about 10 years ago estimated that there were 200 sites with up to 2,000 megawatts of potential. I don't know if all of those that would be developed, but certainly there's a lot of small hydro potential there. And these are on areas that already have impoundments that generally do not have significant impacts on fish or wildlife. Ocean energy. Potential in Oregon is huge. There have been estimates anywhere from 500 megawatts to 5,000. 5,000 is virtually all of Oregon's load. We're a long way from there. There are many issues that have to be resolved, technical issues about the technology, the economics of it, environmental issues, concerns about impacts potentially on marine wildlife and on the ability of fishermen and potential crabbers to use the same areas. But there are seven sites very promising in Oregon. We seem to have some of the best sites in the country, not only in the country, but in fact in the world for potential because of our location in the Atlantic Pacific Ocean. The sites are being evaluated. And in fact, yesterday and today in Coos Bay, there's a major conference on ocean energy. It's the third one last 3 years, and we've had people from all over the world attending it. So the interest is very high. Oregon State University is a leader in research and development. We just received, earlier this month, a new $6.5 million grant from the U.S. Department of Energy for research on ocean energy. So it's one we're keeping our eye on. Very promising in the future. Let me turn now to the tax credits specifically.
I just want to clarify, this isn't revenue TV, however, I did ask you to come and do a brief overview for our members, and I know you're working with revenue TV as well, but the questions that have come up are relevant to the policy aspect, so appreciate that.
And our tax credits went through the policy committee as well as the revenue committee last session because of the major changes that you made in them. We've had increased activity in both the business energy tax credit and the residential energy tax credit. We'll call that senior investment. To give you an idea, throughout the history of the program, the business energy tax credit, we've had over 12,000 businesses invest over $900 million of their money in the tax credit has helped them. They're saving over $300 million a year in energy costs. Most of the projects by volume have been energy efficiency over the years. We've had some renewable resources. And then in 2007, of course, you increased the tax credit for renewable energy from 35% to 50%, raised the cap on eligible costs from $10 million to $20 million. And that's had significant impact on renewable energy development. Give you an idea, in 2006, there was about $50 million of the program was spent by businesses on renewable energy. In 2007, over $90 million, and the changes in 2007 were retroactive to January 1st, 2007. We wanted to send a signal to developers to move ahead on projects. And in 2008, we're on the projects, I'm sorry, that was 50 projects, $10 million in 2006, 90 projects, about $90 million, $12 million in 2007, 150 projects, over $80 million in 2008, so far. Our workload has significantly increased. It's doubled in the last 3 years. We had 2,000 applications of all types in 2006 from businesses. It was over 3,400 in 2007. It's over 4,000 this year. In fact, just yesterday, I asked for and received from the Emergency Board approval to add 3 FTE limited duration just to process tax credits because we have been developing a backlog. The program has been very successful and very busy. We've seen a similar increase on the residential side. We've had on renewable energy over 400 projects in 2005, over 500 in 2006, and over 600 in 2007. The program continues to be very popular. We're seeing increasing numbers of photovoltaics. And we're also seeing increased numbers using that tax credit for energy-efficient appliances. That's where the large volume is, over 40,000 projects a year for energy-efficient appliances, which not only save energy but also save lives. The eligible appliances are dishwashers and washing machines, which are very water-intensive, and then refrigerators and some heating systems and some heating duct systems.
Sir Green, when will we be able to get the information for 2007?
That handout here, this is an independent study that we've commissioned with Eco Northwest, and we've done this periodically over the years. And it summarizes the benefits and the impacts of the tax credits. And on page one, there's a summary there. And this is the impact just from investments made in 2006 for that year alone. And they concluded that there was $142 million increase in economic productivity, 1,200 new jobs created, $18 million increase in wages, $10 million increase in tax revenues, and that's a net increase, taking into account the offsets of the tax credits themselves, and $48 million of energy costs reduced. We have renewed this study. We do hope to have the results before the session starts by the end of this year, so we'll be able to report the impacts of the major changes that you passed last year. And let me mention on revenue impacts.
Just real quickly, make sure I understand this. Paragraph 12 has both bullet points we're talking about. It says that Betsy and Red Sea totaled $73.8 million in tax credits in program administration. That basically is the tax expenditure.
I think so.
So we're spending roughly $74 million and getting at least double that increase every
And then the projects that are built in 2006 or installed will continue to have energy savings benefits and other benefits, but this is the 1 year just from that, and then other projects coming this year. Let me mention revenue impacts. I know that was a concern the last time I was doing that. The previous biennium, we estimated that both the business tax credit and the residential were having a revenue impact of $10 to $11 million or so each year in that area. And that was the official numbers from the Department of Revenue in the tax expenditure report. If you'd asked me at the last committee to estimate the impact in the current program, and I estimated at least $15 million a year for the business tax credit. We haven't seen final numbers from the Department of Revenue yet, but I think they will be substantially higher for both programs. I think the residential tax credit would probably be at least $15 million a year, and I think the business tax credit would be substantially higher because of the volume of activity we've seen, especially renewable energy development. So that the importance of a study like this, an independent study, is underscored, and we will have that for you for the start of the session, so that you can compare, see the benefits, see if it's worth the revenue impacts, and if necessary, we can look at ways to reduce those impacts, give you options and alternatives as well if you decide that this is more than the state can afford. But at the same time, we're clearly seeing benefits not only in the energy produced, but also the jobs and jobs that have been solar manufacturers.
When you're talking about revenue impacts, you're not talking about tax expenditure. That $10 million that you're citing, that's not the amount that shows up as the tax expenditure. You're describing the net positive revenue effect.
The revenue impact is the loss of state money. So that is the expense. That when the Department of Revenue issues it, all the tax expenditure, it covers all of the state income taxes, tax credits, property tax credits, property taxes, anything that reduces taxes, they quantify, say this is the amount of money that hasn't, it's not coming in either. The state government or the local government can measure that would have come in if we didn't have this program.
But just to clarify, for instance, I'm looking at the report, that you're saying that the revenue hit for 2006 for the bond debt CMS was 73.8. And you said it says spending, so that's what I think Representative Cannon's trying to clarify.
And the numbers there are net beyond that. So when the report talks about benefits, they're taking those into account. So these are net benefits beyond the tax credit.
And you're saying for 2007, because the legislation increased the tax credit from 35% to 50%, you can see an increase, you're not sure yet what that increase is.
I'm sorry to belabor this point, but just to make sure that I'm understanding an apples to apples kind of comparison, the projection that you're describing for the current biennium is compared to that 10 to 15 million that you're anticipating that revenue to hit is comparable to the amount of the $1,000. Bringing back to the one year snapshot, the biennium snapshot. But is it the net increase that we saw, the $10 million net increase that we saw in 2006, that we're not expecting to realize in the current biennium because of the increase in that season? Or is it not comparable?
It's not record numbers. These are net benefit numbers. Taking that revenue, because he doesn't have the revenue.
Now you got me confused, Director Green. If I could take a crack at that, I mean, what I heard you say was that you anticipate for this biennium the RETC, the Residential Energy Tax Credit, to be at least $15 million in tax expenditure.
Yes.
And the BETC to be substantially higher than that. So let's just say the BETC is 30 for illustrative purposes. So we're talking $45 million tax expenditure. That would be comparable, if I'm not mistaken, to the $73.8 million that you got on page one, because I thought we established earlier that was the tax expenditure for 2006.
Yes.
That's the combined BETC
yes.
So I think just the clarification you were saying, you expect the RETC alone to be about $16 million per year. Not for biennium, per year, so it'd be $30 million per year. And you don't know if, so we're probably going to see a much larger number than 73.8 that we saw. And this was 1 year. The biennium was down in the older rate. So this was just for 2006. So thank you. We'll have a quick question and then we're going to move along to quite a few other folks.
I appreciate the update. Assessment of how much you're that additional
time to represent. We've got about 4,000 project applications coming in. We've got about 800 project backlog, so we're going to be working full time. There are all types of applications, although the biggest increase has been in solar applications, like this. So we'll be largely focusing on this to get that backlog.
Thank you. Any other questions for Chair for Director Vermeulen? I certainly would like to see more questions. So thank you very much, Chair Beyer, and for Director Brennan. And I know we'll be hearing more from both of you during the next hearing. So next we have a panel. You've heard sort of an overview on renewable portfolio standard and the increases the changes in the business energy and renewable energy tax credit. Now we're going to hear directly from industry folks. We tried to invite folks from the local area so you can hear directly how these policies have impacted Central Oregon, but we do have some folks that are also going to be talking about statewide. So first we're going to hear from a panel of solar experts and solar companies. I don't know if Desiree is back there. Is Desiree here? Okay. So we'll ask Greg Patterson from PV Power and Fred Stewart to come up from Connecticut Energy. Gentlemen, and just please make sure you introduce yourself to the record. And then if you have any PowerPoint presentations or... Greg, why don't you go ahead and go first. And thank you both for coming today. I know you're very busy in projects on the ground or manufacturing and products. I appreciate you being here today.
Yeah, well, thank you for the invite. I'm Greg Patterson. I'm the CEO of PV Powered. We're a company located here in Bend. We've been here about 5 years since we started. We make a key component of the solar system. It's called a grid-tied inverter. Real quickly, just so people understand, that's the product that takes the DC power that all those electric solar electric panels create and converts it into AC power that you can use in your home, business, or most importantly, ship it out on the utility grid so that the power companies can leverage that any extra power that they don't consume. I do have a quick presentation just to talk through. So what I'd like to present is, to a large degree, a quick overview of the solar industry. And my key point that I want to kind of make in this discussion is how significant this industry is from a macroeconomic growth opportunity. And kind of discuss real quickly how I see Oregon and literally the Betsy program and the other incentives that Oregon has. How does that play and what can we do to position Oregon as being a central element of that huge growth engine? So, get this brief screen. Yeah. So, first is solar has matured dramatically in the last 6 or 7 years. The key thing is this is one of the biggest systems in the world today. It's in Germany. It's 40 megawatts. We're currently working with several large developers for utility-scale solar that are 20 times this big, literally up to 800 megawatts of, think of it as a huge solar power plant, typically out in a sunny and dry climate. But the reality is solar is changing dramatically in terms of from a very expensive fringe power generating to now Germany being the worldwide market leader install base, has over 3 gigawatts of solar installed. They're huge. And the other fallacy that people need to understand is that solar is not necessarily need to be in a sunny climate. You know, Germany is actually less sunny than the west side of the Cascades. So, a couple things. First is the track record in growth is tremendous. And if you look at the conservative estimates, this, as you get closer and closer to what's called grid parity, and I'll talk a little bit about that, the expectation is that solar in and of itself will be growing at 30 to 40% a year for the next 20 years because it has some very compelling features to it. One, in terms of renewables, it is very scalable and very small to what you just saw, very large solar installations. Second, that source generates power typically when utilities need peak power. So it allows you to complement peak power demands, which from a utility manager's perspective is the biggest challenge. It's the expensive last kilowatt hour that you need to deliver is the most expensive. So it aligns with peak demand. And this industry is getting huge amounts of notice in terms of the broader renewables. The fundamental investment flows have been over $200 billion going into renewables in the last 2 to 3 years. It's because they see the macroeconomic upside. I mean, energy in itself is a multi-trillion dollar industry, and solar has a significant piece to play. I'll spend some time on this. It's a relatively complex graph, but it provides some context as we look at specifically solar. What you see is a bunch of different lines. The ones that are up and to the left and going down to the right, the left side of this graph shows you the historical reductions in cost per kilowatt hour. And the different lines are the different kinds of PV photovoltaic technologies that are currently in place. And then you see in that lower left corner going to the upper right is what is various scenarios in terms of projecting baseline electricity costs on a per kilowatt hour basis. So the U.S. average in 2006 was about 8.6 cents per kilowatt hour. It varies dramatically across regions. The Southwest and Northeast are actually paying in the range of 15 to 16 cents a kilowatt hour. Here in the Northwest, we have a wonderful luxury of being 67 cents a kilowatt hour. So it varies broadly. And what you see is that little shaded area in the middle is what we in the industry call grid parity, where the cost of solar is actually getting in line with the baseline electricity costs. So that's where you see a huge uptick in the expected kind of real anomaly in terms of growth and deployments. Our challenge in the world today, and for sure in the U.S. and now in Oregon, is how do you accelerate that move to that grid parity point? Because the opportunity is to invest now, both at a national and a state level. Because once you get to that, the growth opportunities and economic benefits of literally scaling solar, which is about a tenth of 1% of the total electricity generating capabilities in the world, to literally being 30%+, which is a lot of people feel is the right balance or portfolio that solar can bring long term. Some people say 60, but conservatively people think it could be at least 30% of total electric generating capabilities worldwide. So as I came into PV powered, my previous life was an exec at HP in the green energy business. These macroeconomic drivers and upside, I think, has huge benefits to Oregon. And the opportunities and the challenges is that how does Oregon continue to be positioned as a leader? Because the leadership of the governor and literally the legislature and a bunch of the agencies has really positioned Oregon as an amazing player in this market. And there's huge competition. Countries are competing dramatically. The investments in Germany, Japan, and Spain dwarf everything we've done in the U.S. just because they see the job creation benefits of this industry. And I think that's the opportunity for us to don't lose the leadership that we have. And Betsy is a key part of that. It has been absolutely essential for us to generate our growth. I joined the company just under 2 years ago, and we've doubled in size in terms of employment here in Bend. And we're just starting to make hay on the market. We're building traction, and we've got record revenue the last few months. And with hopefully the ITC passing the House and hopefully getting signed in D.C., that's going to continue this market growing in the U.S., and we're rapidly going to try to explore how do we move into both Europe and Asian markets as an exporter. So, with that, I'll end.
Started in the position of the
record.
Craig Stewart, Director of Project Development for Tanner Creek Energy.
Are you based out of?
Based out of Portland.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you had mentioned that, but you're based here. Mm-hmm.
We have moved from about a 16 or 17,000 square feet of total space to a 100,000 square foot facility that we're just dying to fill.
Provide a contractor's perspective of the solar industry, and first I'll describe Tanner Creek Energy, what we're about, then show you some examples of projects that we've completed in the past year, and then examine how Betsy has really significantly helped our business. We are a full-service turnkey contractor based out of Portland. We started also about 2 years ago. Actually, the initiation of the 50% Betsy was a big boost to our company. We design. We take the project from design all the way to controlling the management of the building. We get permitting accomplished. And this requires an in-depth knowledge of Betsy, MTO, and the financing behind each project. We are strictly commercial industrial, photovoltaic. We do not do thermal residential, although we are strongly supported in those markets. We are Oregon-based and Oregon-focused, meaning all of our subs, consultants and manufacturers, to the degree we are capable of doing, are based here in Oregon. We use PV power converters. In fact, I've got a nice photograph coming up. Really pleased to show
it.
Great. They are very good.
And we're delighted to have PV power here that supports our Oregon base and Oregon storage. So here are some examples of projects we've completed recently. This is a 50 kilowatt project in Carlton. It's a vineyard. Vineyards are very supportive of the solar movement, and it's a wonderful application for their business. This is a ground-mounted system. We recently completed this project in Bend. Although the business, the facility has not been completed, the solar is completed. I love that. And I tell you, I'm a project manager, and so I go spend a lot of time on the roofs, and this was a job I enjoyed thoroughly, being on the roof of this project. Yeah, exactly. What you can't see in this picture is there's a PV powered 30 kW inverter in the room just below this.
Not as pretty as that.
This is a 95 kilowatt. This is our largest system, close to 100 kilowatts in Dundee. This particular project posed significant challenges for us, not necessarily from a jurisdictional point of view, but from just siting it. There are multiple slopes here, and the challenges were enormous, but we feel very good about the result. And if you look down here on the side, these are three of Greg's inverters that we're delighted to install there. They're working very well.
Just a quick question on the size of these projects. Is this mainly for running the operations, or are they also doing some net metering?
Well, they're all net metered, they're all grid-tied systems, but the percentage, it depends on each of the projects. We don't know, for example, the West Schwab, because they're building this and completing it. So with the Lumsden, it's about 40% of their usage. This will be, as far as the same, 100 kilowatts, probably I'll say it's 40%. This is a facility we put in Tualatin, and I'd like to point this out for a couple of reasons, and one which I'll address in a minute, but more closely. This was a challenging installation. One of the things we've come upon is that there are jurisdictional inconsistencies, and the industry is so young that a lot of the jurisdictions are not quite prepared to deal with it. They don't have a solar category in the building permit department, for example. In Tualatin, the challenges we faced here were we had to keep a low profile of the panels below the level of the parapet so that it couldn't be seen. Well, that changed the amount of electricity we could generate just by the angle of the panels. So that's one of the challenges. The other was that we had to hire a structural engineer and spend a fair sum of money to ensure that this is a ballasted system, and the first in the metropolitan area, the ballast it means to put weight on the panels to keep them from flying away. And it had to be engineered specifically to pass the local codes. That was very successful. It's still there producing electricity. As a matter of fact, this system has produced more electricity than it was originally planned to. So it's a good year for solar. These incentives, the four incentives that make our business particularly attractive, include the grants from the rebate from Energy Trust of Oregon. Of course, the Betsy has been fabulous for us. The Federal Investments Tax Credit, which Greg mentioned, is imminent to be passed. We're crossing our fingers that it passes the president's desk. And then there is an accelerated depreciation that businesses use to get these systems in. And based on our calculations, it is possible for these systems to be paid off in 4 to 7 years, and then the production capacity will last for anywhere up to 25 to 30. So we are excited about the potential deployment. And the business energy tax credit helps us do that. It keeps us competitive. It allows businesses like Greg's to come into the state. We are excited about the opportunity to work with Solar World and PV Powered and to create an entire Oregon-based solar business. In fact, we have a project, a 100 kW project, coming online that in fact does use solar wind panels, PV powered inverters, and some other based company at this moment. We're allowed to divulge who that is, but it will happen by the end of this year. I'd have to say the Department of Energy, it was interesting listening before, that they have been swamped with applications, and we, from our perspective, we have had nothing but good reports and good interactions with the department, and we're really grateful for their assistance in getting our projects in the ground. One of the things that's a challenge for us is that the jurisdictions do have different guidelines, especially with regards to building. The electrical code interpretation is pretty standard, but building is often different. The Building Codes Division is taking steps to make those standard, and they've been very helpful. One thing I'd like to point out from our estimates, $700,000 of wages have gone back into the system from the credits we've received, the tax credits, and working with these people locally, the electricians, construction excavators, and engineers. Now, it doesn't include the upstream wages that Greg's company or Solar World will have.
So how many employees do
we have? We have 5 employees at Tanner Creek, and then
the
contract, exactly. And we're excited about the future for solar. I think Greg is right on the mark. This is a great time for solar, and the Betsy has really helped this industry take off. So I thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Put your foot there. And that's what I have.
Thank you, gentlemen. I take questions. My vice chair of representative questions.
Just a comment, Madam Chair, by way of introduction of Greg. He was a mentor teacher of mine the first year that I taught. Last year, I returned to the state school. So the solar industry's game was middle schoolers lost. phenomenal teaching talent. And it was great. So it was just really pleasurable to see him on the campus today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greg, I'm kind of curious as to the problems you run into in your chain of events to put a successful completion of a project. Is there a common area that you run into most of the problems with in local jurisdictions?
Right, that's a good question, and I would have to say our experience is limited to the projects we've done so far, which is roughly, we're putting nine in. There has been some hurdles to cover in terms of the height of racking. If it's above 6 feet, you need a grading permit and a land use review in certain counties. And if it's below 6 feet, it's considered a fence, and you don't need a building review or a building permit or land plan review. We love working in Yamhill County for that reason. They're very, very accommodating. That's the one that comes to mind to me. there are issues with buildings. For example, you see the 12s, we didn't allow us to have our panels visible. That creates some constraints and some design shuffling, so to speak. On a statewide level, I think I can't think of anything offhand. It's been very supportive, very understanding of the needs to be consistent across the board. Andrea Simmons has done a fabulous job, actually.
I've been working very closely with Andrea on the water energy building code revisions. And I know that they can make the first motion revision on barriers at the state level.
Mm-hmm. No, and she's been fabulous. She's really paved the way. I would say also that a ballasted system, the one I pointed out in Tualatin, that is receiving some resistance in certain cities. It's not accepted just offhand that a ballasted system is a good thing. So we've had to do some muscle work there. That's understandable. But I think the more we get into this industry, the more it will be common for us. So it's a young industry.
Chair, gentlemen, this question is for either one of you. The state's investment appears to be driving much of this activity, that is good. But over what period of time would you guess that the cost of these improvements is going to drop to a point where the state's investment is no longer necessary?
That's the question that we get all the time. And let me give you some context on, you know, what's the variation. But generally, if I just fit to the answer, kind of 2015, but that's plus or minus 3 to 4 years, 2 million or so, because who knows what the baseline electricity costs are going to be. Is that grid parity where you absolutely do not need any incentives to fund and support projects? It's going to be highly dependent on what's the baseline cost of what is still generally a fossil fuel-driven electrical power source. So that's one. Second thing is, we are working closely with a lot of the big PV companies, be it Solar World and others around the world, and there's all sorts of new technologies that reduce the cost of those panels, which is the majority of the cost of the solar system itself, to drive efficiency up and cost down. And there's some wild cards out there that, if they play out, would be of a disruptive change in our cost structure as an industry. So that's why there's a lot of variation in the right place. But that's our best guess on when we truly get grid parity. The thing that, if you want to look at even more sophisticated, is peak power generation can be 3 to 5x more expensive than your baseline electricity rate. So you have to turn a natural gas facility on and off. It's much more expensive than if you have somewhat free wind or hydro. Much, much cheaper. And so, as solar is a great solution for peak power demand, utilities can look at that in a very different way than potentially a residential user. So we see a huge opportunity in utility-scale solar for that reason, especially with some of the incentives that are coming in from the federal. If the current investment tax credit package passes both the House and gets to the President's signature, there's a lot of upside there as well.
It's probably going to be a little bit more common question. This is about the kind of the workforce problem that's going to be sold out projects that we've done in Washington to try and train a workforce for this energy industry that we're developing here. I guess one of the things we have to be very attentive to here is, you know, we provide those programs in whatever means possible, not only for the type of skills that you gentlemen would need, but also to improve the transmission grid and all the stuff that's associated with this. So, you want to comment briefly, perhaps, but otherwise, you know, I'd encourage you to let us know here as time goes on what, as a legislative body, we can do to help the country as well.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, the California market has been the lead market in the U.S., and for the last 2 years especially, the limit in the growth of that market has been driven by skilled labor. I mean, these are great jobs. What Craig and Tenor Creek drive in terms of their contract labor pool needs to be skilled. It's great green-collar jobs in terms of family wage jobs. And that training is significant because there's a lot of people that may know electrical. Very few work with DC, which is the key thing. So it is one of the things that from an infrastructure and macroeconomic growth for an employment base, there is a fundamental challenge there. It's a great opportunity for community colleges and trades organizations to pitch in. So, absolutely. And those will be spread everywhere. I mean, that's where you're not going to be concentrating just a manufacturing corridor, be it the Silicon Forest or on the west side, so forth. But that's where you get a very broad economic activity.
Right, I would really simply add to that that the design, teaching electrical engineers to design these DC systems is crucial. I would encourage our state system to, and they're actually, they're getting on it too. I would encourage that to, as you say, to invest more time in engineering.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Power electronics has not been a sexy part of technical development, especially on the PC side, but it's rapidly changing. So I think that's it. There is an educational element and an infrastructure element.
Thank you. And we're going to finish up with our last. I'm going to ask the last three speakers to come up together because there's three mics up here. We have Elon Hassan from Verizon Wind Energy. We have another local Bend company, IDATEC, and we have Eric Simpson, and then Fred Gordon from the Energy Trust Board.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Green, for the record. I think I was asleep at the switch in our earlier discussion. I'm confused a little on this tax credit revenue impact. So $73 million of tax credits. That's the tax credits approved that year. I failed to mention that the business tax credit is taken over 5 years and there's a carry forward provision. So that causes the revenue impacts. That's not the revenue impacts. The Department of Revenue takes this number and then goes through its calculations and determines what the revenue impact is. But this number will be larger for 07 and 08, and that in turn will cause a larger revenue impact. And that's what we'll know at the end of this year. So I apologize for that.
Thanks for the clarification. Elon, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and we can start.
My name's Elon Hassan. I'm from Horizon Wind Energy. I'm a project manager there. And I thought I'd go through just a little bit of the history of Horizon, how we got here, what we're working on, and what we're looking forward to in the next couple of years. Horizon started as Zilka Energy that came to the Northwest about 7 years ago. And in part, it was the vision of the folks who started it, because they thought about the Northwest and the people who are here and what we want over the course of time. So although there was no renewable portfolio standard in place at the time, the idea of Oregon and Washington sort of found them here. And you know, 7 years later, the renewable portfolio standard became reality. And the effects have been pronounced. We have over 1,000 megawatts in pipeline development here in Oregon. Developed about 300 megawatts in Oregon, and each megawatt is enough to power a Northwest house, or power about 300 Northwest houses. So it's about 90,000 houses here in the Pacific Northwest. Wind farms are expensive and large facilities to put in. They take about, during construction, we'll have about 200, 250 jobs per site. And then there's about 10 to 12 permanent jobs are associated with the wind farms once they're operational. Horizon is an owner-operator wind producer, which means we maintain the wind producing and we don't sell it. So we're here to be a long-term neighbor in these projects. Economically speaking, the nice thing about these projects is there are a lot of them are in rural Oregon. We're working in Harney County, Union County, Gillen, Sherman. We've got a wind farm coming online next Thursday in Arlington called Rattlesnake Canyon, and another one this spring called Wheatfield. The Oregon's been very friendly, and I think the important thing to think about where we look at things is Oregon's competing not just with Washington for renewable energy, but also with Wyoming and sometimes Minnesota and the Midwest states, which have a lot of wind. So everything that we do here drives more of the national investments in renewable energy in the Oregon, which is better than going somewhere else. In terms of what we're looking at ahead, as I said, we've got a lot of projects in line. Our company's increased in staffing. I think in 2000 we were 40 employees. Now we're approaching 300. Everything's gearing up, and everyone's working really hard to get things on the ground. By far, the most important thing is transmission, which I think we're going to talk about. And Horizon just demonstrated our commitment to being here and talk about that earnest money that was put up. Horizon paid $40 million to improving the transmission system here and through BPA's open season. Transmission really is going to be the main thing over time that we're going to be working with. We've also worked closely with BLM and FSEC to try and streamline some of the processes. We do copious testing for wind farm environmental and biological natural resources, flight patterns, microwave, you name it, we test it. That all takes a lot of time. Just anything to be streamlined is always helpful. Perhaps a little bit of a play for more FTEs in those areas. For FSEC, they've got great staff. We work well with everyone in state. It's all together. It's just that I think the government employees are overwhelmed with requests. Everything we hear for today is more and more stuff coming in the pipeline. Something that we're doing that 5 years ago, they were used to a much lighter load. So I think all around people are that's all I really had. I'd be happy to answer any questions or expand on any
of
My name is Eric Simpkins. I'm Vice President for Government Affairs for Hydratec, which is a Bend-based fuel cell development and production company. Bend was established in 1996 here in Bend. Today, we employ about 87 professionals, 70% of which are degree professionals. We have a total of 7 fully certified fuel cell power systems, which I'll discuss a little bit more in a minute as to why that's significant. We use a wider range of fuels than any other fuel cell company in the world, and we're developing systems worldwide. A couple other points that I'd like to make before I go on is that the technology that Hydratec has developed has allowed us to be able to use a wider variety of fuels than any other fuel cell developer. And that's significant because most fuel cell companies sell to their customers fuel cell power systems that operate with bottled hydrogen. And hydrogen is expensive, hydrogen is difficult to site, particularly in remote locations, and there are a lot of safety issues with hydrogen that would require setbacks and other considerations. We view fuels as a carrier of hydrogen. We don't use hydrogen by itself, though we can, but we use fuels that carry hydrogen. We extract hydrogen from those fuels and use them safely. Thus, we don't store hydrogen. We don't have to manage the safety issues associated with hydrogen production. A couple of other brief statistics about our little company in Central Oregon. We have 20% of fuel cell production capacity in North America and Europe. And after the first of the year, we're going to be the first company in the world to be using a renewable feedstock. This will be a biomethanol that will be produced in the United States. Biomethanol that we will use will come from waste, landfill waste, wood waste, from forests, food waste, and other sources. To give you a sense of what the industry is like today, our trade association has 116 members. There are about 60 fuel cell companies in the U.S., Canada, and Europe that are members of this trade association. A grand total of about 55 commercial products are sold by the members of the fuel cell community. Hydratec has 7 power plants, as I mentioned earlier, which is about 1/8 of the total produced in North America. Today, the industry is about a $700 million a year business. By 2015, it's projected that we could be as much as a $10 billion business. I should mention that There's a developing fuel cell industry in Oregon. It used to be just Idatech 10 years ago. Now there are three fuel cell companies, two in the valley and ours here. And that we're a young but developing industry. The Business Energy Tax Credit is helping us all, and I'll briefly discuss how that is in just a moment. Idatech today has about 100 fuel cell power plants deployed on five continents and Oceania. By the end of next year, we hope to have in the range of between 400 and 500 power plants. So we're a quickly growing business. An example of a fuel cell is here on the table. This is a 250-watt fuel cell power plant to give you a sense of what it could power. It could power the speaker system, the lights, and this laptop in this room. Power plants that our company produces, you see on the picture there, range from this 250-watt industrial system to a 5-kilowatt, what we call an electrogen system. These operate, as I mentioned earlier, on a wide variety of fuels. Our fuel of choice are the alcohols and methanol, not that kind of alcohol, but methanol and a water mixture. And the reason for that is it's very affordable and allows our customers to be able to operate fuel cells in a very cost-effective way. You will hear that fuel cells are expensive to buy. They are. They're unaffordable if you look at them as an acquisition price basis. But if we look at the life cycle cost of fuel cells, given the fact that life fuel cells have virtually no maintenance and they last very long, the life cycle cost bears that we're competitive with the grid in most applications. Betsy, the Business Energy Tax Credit has been an incredible source to Idatech and is becoming more important to the other two fuel cell companies in Oregon as well. In that it helps to us to develop the technology through our in-house research and development efforts that allow us to serve the kind of markets that that you see on this chart. So we're very thankful for that. I've been asked to describe briefly a couple of ways in which the state could accelerate the deployment of fuel cell power systems, which I'll do now. About a year and a half ago, Governor Kulongoski directed that 10 fuel cell systems be purchased and deployed by Oregon state agencies. The first of these has been sited just yesterday at the Oregon State Police site at Cape Perpetua near Yahats. This is a backup fuel cell power system that supplements the grid should the grid be lost at that telecommunications site. And Tsunami Warning Center there at Cape Perpetua, the fuel cell immediately snaps on, and there's a seamless supply of electricity to the user. We're hopeful that the other 9 systems will be acquired by state agencies in the near term. On a longer term basis, in the last biennium session, HB 2625 was considered. Made it almost to the goal line and then didn't quite get across the line. This is to provide incentives to state agencies through establishing a lottery bond fund grants for the acquisition of fuel cells from all of the fuel cell companies in Oregon as pilot demonstration facilities. Other states have done this, notably Washington State, Florida and Connecticut, as I recall, and that has significantly jump-started the job creation for fuel cell industries, the contractors, the fuel suppliers, the installers, and so on, for that industry. As I mentioned, Betsy's been an incredible help to us. We're on the lower end of the Betsy scale today, and we hope that through the enactment of the recommendation of the Governor's Renewable Energy Working Group, to have fuel cells receive 50% credit. And the basis for that is that we essentially meet the governor's criteria for being a non-polluting, ultra-clean technology. And you can see a picture of my little skyscraper in the lower right hand corner. That we're a minimum of at least 30% more efficient than conventional generation systems today, including on-site diesel gensets, and that, as I mentioned, we can use renewable fuels, although we don't do it today, and by this time next year, I'll be able to report that we have several dozen fuel cell systems sited that will be using renewable biomethanol. We'd also like to recommend that fuel cells be added to the Oregon Clean Diesel Program that's managed by ODOE. And include the funding credits for acquisition of fuel cells that replace noisy and polluting diesel systems. And last, we'd like to consider or propose that the legislature require facilities managers, architects, and engineers to consider the use of fuel cell systems for new state agency building facilities and repowering existing facilities. We would ask the Department of Energy to establish criteria through that legislative action that would define emissions, life cycle costs, and equipment complexity. That ODOE would then monitor and report back to the committee on the impacts of these fuel cell systems to the energy environment. Thanks very much for holding your field hearing here in Central Oregon. We certainly appreciate you coming here to do that. And thanks for the opportunity to give testimony.
Thank you. I'll ask if there's a question. Greenberg East to General Report of the Energy Trust. Please let us know.
What's the average cost?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's, it doesn't have a simplistic answer, unfortunately. This fuel cell system here today is priced at about $5,000. We hope to have that within the next 2 years on a commercial basis. That makes it competitive with other on-site generation.
How large is it?
This is a quarter of a kilowatt. Now, fuel cells, kind of like batteries, are different kinds of fuel cell technologies, and this is really on the lower end. The only thing smaller than this is a fuel cell that a couple of companies are developing for soldier wearable power, so they would put it in the backpack and use it to power the stuff that they carry with them. On the other end of the scale are megawatt facilities. Solid oxide and molten carbon fuel cell technologies are high-temperature technologies that can generate anything up to about 10 megawatts per power plant. And when you scale up to that range, your cost per kilowatt acquisition cost reduces substantially.
Came to my mind actually when we heard Director Green's presentation, and you mentioned how many homes can be powered by a megawatt of wind. Could you cite that figure?
Yeah. Chair Dinkfelder, Representative Cannon, it's about one Northwest home, 300 Northwest homes per megawatt.
I guess my question is how that compares with firm power or coal or gas. If we're comparing megawatts of one and megawatts of another, if your project, Horizon Project, and all of those that Director Green described as coming online, we have this huge boom of thousands of new megawatts, and our base load under Director Green, right, requirement is worth roughly 5,000 megawatts. Maybe it's really a question more for him than for you, but wondering how a megawatt of wind compares, how much of that load requirement a megawatt of wind supply?
I assume a megawatt of a megawatt, so it's the same power. There's no difference between a megawatt produced by wind versus coal, other than, in terms of the electrons. There's availability issues, there's some base load issues.
Maybe we can ask Director Green if he wants to address that.
The capacity factor for wind is about a third. So if 1,000 megawatts capacity of wind would produce about 300 megawatts of power. About that 300 megawatts would be the same whether it's coal or gas or wind. That's where you take the variability. And with all these wind projects, even taking that capacity factor into account when they're all online, it would be equivalent of three or four natural gas plants and a couple of large coal plants, so it's quite simple. And the variability you can take somewhat into account with location differences, wind area differences. And you do have the same issue to a lesser extent, even with coal and natural gas and nuclear plants. They'll all fly too. And you have variability, but not as big a variability.
It's so application dependent. It's difficult. Fuel cells are used in homes, industry, businesses, for automotive applications, and the life cycle varies wildly across all of those. Typically speaking, in very general terms, what we're trying to do is meet what is locally available for power generation to a customer in terms of life cycle costs. For commercial businesses, that means we want to be in the range of 5 to 7.5 cents per kilowatt hour, which they would probably double. In military applications, which we also serve, the mission is more important than the cost of the military. So mission enabling technologies like fuel cells really outweigh the cost. Are designed, a lot of power plants today are warranty for 2 years. We hope to multiply that by 5 in the near term, and we will be able to do that. The limiting item in a fuel cell power plant, and there's 1,000 parts in a typical fuel cell power plant, the limiting item is the fuel cell stack, which is kind of like the battery in the car. It's the anode and cathode layer device. Today we're seeing lifetimes of 4 to 5, maybe 6,000 hours for those. 3 years we're seeing less than half of that. So the technology is improving rapidly.
Thank you. Now we're going to our last speaker on the energy panel is the Energy Trust of Oregon, with Ted Gordon. Good to see you. Thank you for the presentation.
Yes, I do, and you've got handouts coming to you over the Adam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Fred Gordon. I'm the Director of Planning and Evaluation at the Energy Trust of Oregon. I'm going to take a minute to refresh you on who we are, and then go on to try to explain how we're helping to meet the RPS renewable portfolio standard. You might need some help with getting this fitting and finding it. You just have to rely on your handouts. It's probably very easy to time. We are a product of the restructuring legislation of 1999, Senate Bill 1149. I got the 4 in the wrong place. It established a public purpose charge. We serve the customers of investor-owned utilities. We are funded through their rates. We're a nonprofit. We're chartered by the Public Utility Commission. Our electric contract is with them. We also have separate arrangements with the gas companies to provide efficiency for Oregon's three gas utilities. We also provide renewable energy programs as well as efficiency programs. Our funding was set at a piece of the 3% under Oregon 49. There is some more funding coming in as part of the renewable portfolio standard bill. Utilities can propose to the PUC additional cost-effective efficiency funding, and we're getting some more funding under that legislation this year, and it's accelerating next. Our mission is here. You can read it faster than I can say it. Basically, we're to help efficiency renewable energy happen for ratepayers and citizens of Oregon. What do? We make it happen. Oregon's got a great set of state programs, tax credits, loans, and so on. Our job is, what else does it take?
information, technical assistance, sometimes funding, arranging, matchmaking. We do what it takes. We go to customers, we go to developers, and we find out how to make the deals work. Who do we report to? Our contract for electric efficiencies with the Public Utility Commission will work very closely with utilities. Our gas contracts are with utilities, working very closely with the PUC. We are run by an independent volunteer board. The original board was appointed by the PUC. Now they appoint replacement members with representatives from all over Oregon. And they're our policy control organ. The PUC works closely with them, but they're our most direct, close oversight. We report biennially as part of a report out of Oregon Department of Energy to the legislature on 1149 expenditures. We'll be getting those reports in the next year. We have advisory committees representing vendors and interested parties, customers, for conservation and separately renewable energy. And we work very closely with utilities on marketing, planning, and project funding. We also work very closely with ODO to package tax credits, loans, our incentives, our technical help, their information, our marketing, so we can make things as seamless as possible for consumers. I'm not going to go through this list of accomplishments. I apologize and say there's a couple of updates from what we provided Chairman Beyer, because we got our third quarter forecast in. This is to say, since 2002 when we've started, we're cumulatively getting a lot of work done. It's looking close to 300 average megawatts of generation and efficiency. I just point out the third bullet, which is by the end of this year, we believe we will have helped sell to the utilities 101 average megawatts. That's average megawatts of renewable energy. That's a lot of renewable energy. And there's lots of numbers about how many houses and so on, which you can take home and go blind reading. The renewable energy act at 838 requires the RPS. You've been told about that. It shifts our role. We were helping to buy down the above-market cost of any renewables, and we were working a lot with large wind projects as well as small projects. Under the new legislation, utilities are going to buy a certain amount of renewable energy. They're going to buy the cheapest thing they can find. A lot of that's large wind. There might be some large biomass in that. Our focus was shifted under the legislation to 20 megawatt or less projects. The legislation also allowed us to see the utilities to propose some additional efficiency funding, which is happening. There is a goal in the legislation for some of the renewables to be community energy. We believe that means the smaller resources that we're helping to fund. And it also extends the public purpose charge for efficiency out to 2025. Our previous sunset date was 2012. So we're clarifying the question before I move on. How do we help meet the RPS? We help utilities buy a greater diversity of renewable resources. We focus on smaller resources. There's a list a little further on. How do we help? We provide funding and technical assistance in arranging so that new technologies get demonstrated that are near commercial but are not in wide use yet. We help property owners and developers put together the package. Not all people wanting to develop small resources are developers who know how to do the whole deal, have experience. You've got municipalities, irrigation districts, and so on. So we help them put the team together, and we buy down the above-market cost of resources. And we try to figure out what the formula is for each type of renewable, what they need, how much of each help they need, and how much money we give them, how much help depends on where the gaps are. What do we hope to do in the period of the RPS? A lot of how much more we can get depends on commodity prices, electric prices, federal tax policy. We're not driving the show. We're trying to put in the tip, but we're trying to be the last dollar, the last help. So our estimates are we could add between 88 and 195 additional average megawatts. Looking at anybody's guess of loads, that might, at the high end, reach 3% of that 8% community energy goal, so we're contributing towards that goal. I should say that we, the IOUs, are 70% of Oregon's electric load, 30% is public utilities that are served by other mechanisms. So there's other ways that both can get met, other than us, there's state programs and so on. We're providing more diversity, and that does a few things, one of which you've heard today about how a lot of the Oregon wind has about the same cycle. You can
balance that out, you get more smooth load by getting wind from other places that turns on at different times. Other renewables have other operating schedules, and you get a diversity of renewable energy. The load shape flattens out, looks more like when there's demand for power. So it lessens the problem of trying to back it up with gas. You can back it up with other renewables. Also, these are more local, so the transmission issues are somewhat reduced if you can get more local resources. And it provides some hedges in case you can't get enough large wind. There's other ways to get to your goals. Another thing that we're doing through efficiency is the RPS goal is 25% of load. We're knocking off somewhere around 1% of load a year now, meaning if your load grew 2%, it would now grow 1%. We're moving up towards 1.5% per year. The more you reduce your loads, the smaller the renewables requirement for RPS is. So by driving a massive amount of efficiency into Oregon's economy, we're reducing the requirements of the renewable portfolio industry. What are the resources? They're all the resources that we buy are presented. There's a small end to each one of those. A lot of the folks we work with are Oregon industries, as well as homeowners, and municipalities and municipal entities like irrigation districts. A lot of these resources are on different places on the development scale and the mass production scale in the price curve towards marketability. And we help them get down that price curve. We help develop the infrastructure so it can be developed in larger scale and efficiently. WAVE is something Oregon's very interested in. Because it's pure research and development now, we're not in that yet. There are other people doing that work. Chairman Dinkfelder asked us to talk about what are we doing and what aren't we doing with our money. The agreements for efficiency now say that if we can prove there are more resources that are cheaper than fossil fuel, we can ask for money. The utilities will propose them through integrated resource planning. And at least in principle, we can get all resources cheaper than fossil funded under law now. Renewables, SB 1149 had an allocated fund. It's a great thing. It's a limited amount of money. And one of our dilemmas is we started out a few years ago developing a bunch of different renewables, assuming some of them would fail and go away at this point. And they're not all market price, but they're all doing well, and there are people developing them. They have promise, and people want to go take the next steps. So there are things we haven't been able to do right now. We've identified a whole bunch more solar electric than we can leverage with our last dollar funding. And we've had to limit what we do for we had a municipality program. We had a great contractor marketing it, and he's fleshed up a multiple of the demand of what we can fund right now. So we've had to close that offer off for the year. We're doing some of the projects, and we've got to stop. And we've had to cap the size of commercial projects probably below the engineering optimum just so we can get enough projects going. Part of what we're trying to do is get the industry moving, and we're juggling how many resources we do, how many projects we do, which renewables we do right now. Community wind, small wind projects are having trouble securing the large turbines. Community wind is like a community would like to own and run a limited number of turbines in a pocket of area that's got wind. And the manufacturers want to sell $1 billion of a shot right now. And they'll do multiple turbine sales if you twist their arm. We could try to take an aggregator role. That's really complicated. But the bottom line is we don't have enough money to do that. Locking up that much money in turbines would be killing other programs. Can't do it. Geothermal, there are people interested in more exploration. It's one to several million a pop. Again, that's a risk investment. And given the size of our budget, we're not making those risk investments. We're asking them to look elsewhere to do that. Small hydro projects like irrigation districts and municipalities, we're getting some of them done. They slow down a lot at the pre-construction financing stage. We're not locking up money in that. And this is so that we can do all the other things that we listed. We're doing solar. We're doing some small hydro. We're doing some municipal projects and so on. But these are the larger lock-up, big piece of money investments that you need a larger fund to put that in your portfolio and know that you're going to be saving or generating some energy every year. So we're getting a lot of work done. There's a lot more interest out there. Things are starting to move, and there's things we're not doing yet. And at that point, I'll see if you've got any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ford, for the place for the clear presentation. Questions?
Has the cost changed the policy retire those wrecks and retire them sometime.
You've been walking the line, Vice Chair Burley, between trying to get a bunch of renewable projects up and going and trying to get the green tags so that they help meet the RPS. And what we're doing now, we've got a policy that's been modified over the last couple of years to say we would like to, as part of our contract to help fund a facility, capture green tags that are basically commensurate with the amount of money we're putting in. We would like it to be the share of the above market cost that we pay, but we recognize that there's a market value for green tags, and people are regarding us as somebody who's co-funding, but we want something back. So the utilities are very interested in us helping to meet the renewable portfolio standard and meet the state's goals. And so what we're asking is about what we think the market value of our share of the funding is. So we have created more flexibility in our policy, recognizing that there's a market price for green tags.
Jordan, if I understand correctly, I mean, your source of capital comes from public funds, which is levied on the ratepayers of the escrow utilities in the state.
That's correct.
So, who actually gets credit? Who gets these green tags? Who gets to say we're complying with the RPS when the money you're investing is coming from the ratepayers? Now, I could see maybe if those IOUs are actually buying the power for that project, but what if the power is being sold to Southern California? And who gets the tags?
Our projects are sold to the Oregon IOUs, first of all. The power is the green tags, the ones that we purchase, we hand over to the utilities to retire on behalf of ratepayers. So to the extent our money will buy the green tags, they're handed to the utilities, they're retired, and they help meet the renewable portfolio standard.
Very quickly then, are those utilities necessarily buying that power?
Yes.
That's a condition.
Some of our very small facilities are mostly used, the power is used on site. If it's sold, it's sold to PacifiCorp or PG&E, funded by and power sold to.
Yeah, you mentioned something that I found interesting. When a utility is doing its planning for how to meet the needs of the group, it is allowed to go to you and say, well, we've determined that the lowest cost way of meeting the needs would be to invest in energy efficiency and use the energy program. We've heard over and over again that the cheapest form of the energy is in fact energy efficiency. Are they taking advantage of this ability to come to you with that?
Yes, sir. You have PUC and utilities who at this point recognize that anything other than efficiency and renewables they do has huge risks and unpredictable costs, and they want to get as much as they can. They are relying on us, the utilities, to quantify how much efficiency can be had, and we work out with them how quickly we can accelerate. And right now, the limiting factor on efficiency acquisition is acceleration. We're trying to make sure that we are accelerating in a way that we're providing a reliable resource and building an industry in an orderly fashion. We added about $10 million this year. We're adding about $15 million next year in efficiency acquisitions on the electric side. And we're working with them to discover new resources and continue to grow the resource. So I'd say the utilities are working very closely with us and very well to plan for efficiency as part of their resource needs.
Well, I really appreciate the update. It sounds like there's still quite an unmet need based on the information that you presented. There's anything in the future. Thanks for coming over today. Appreciate it. Next, we are going to, and I guess the fuel cell is going to be over here.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Parker.
Hello, from Portland. I would like to make a request of one of my colleagues from Portland, if possible, to bring back any of the materials that have been handed out there that I would be able to look at afterwards, if that is possible.
Our committee chair will make sure that, or committee staff will make sure that you get the materials.
Very good. Thank you very much.
The PowerPoint presentations that were handed out today, so send those out to all the committee members as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I apologize. If you do have questions, just feel free to jump in as well.
I have been participating, listening in on all of it, making many notes, and after I get those other materials, I may contact some people with questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. And now we're going to move on to water issues for the remainder of the hearing, and I will just give a brief update on the first statewide water roundtable that we had here in Bend yesterday. And I don't know if it's Patrick, I can't see all the way back there. There he is. So Patrick, why don't you come up and you can sort of help provide just a quick overview on the water planning today. And we have several people in the audience who's also there. But just as a reminder, colleagues, I'm sure you remember some discussions in the past that this is an effort I've been working on with a number of different partners, Governor's Office, the Water Resources Commission, and the Oregon State University, many other partners. A series of roundtables that we're doing over in the state. The first one was here yesterday, so we kicked off in Bend, had over 70 participants. At that, it was a half day. We met from about noon to almost 6 o'clock, so it was a really well-attended and dynamic meeting. We have some refinement to do, but I think overall we had really good feedback. And also, I would like to thank Representative Vance for being there the entire time and is also co-hosting the Ontario one. So, Representative, would you like to add anything about that before I hand it over to Patrick Griffith from the City of Bend to talk about local issues?
I would only say that I was impressed by the quality of the remarks made by the folks that attended, and I thought it was a good effort. There's lots of challenges facing Oregon when it comes to water, and many of those challenges kind of wait for a crisis to develop, and hopefully this is not going to be after some of those issues. I thought the issue that was of greatest interest to me is the challenge we face in competing with other states for water, and I'm sure that issue is going to come up again, and I'm sure that other places. I thought some progress was made, and I'm hopeful that as we go through the rest of the round table, more ideas will come up. I think it's going to require us.
Well, thank you, and appreciate your input on that. And I would encourage my colleagues to attend any of the ones that are in your area, and I know that Beth has sent out the schedule. It's also on the Institute for Water and Watershed website. And over the next 3 weeks, we'll be in Newport, Medford, Salem, and in Ontario. So we hope that you can attend at least one of them. It's really important information. And really, a lot of local-based information, that's the focus of these roundtables, is not for the sake to come in and say, here's what we're going to do. It's we're working on a proactive approach, long-term vision for Oregon's water resources. We want to hear from you what your key issues and priorities are. And I have to say, I heard a lot of really excellent information today, and I was really impressed with folks who took time out of their busy schedules to come and share their concerns with us. So with that, Patrick, I'd like to see if you want to add anything, and thank you for coming here today. Patrick Griffith is the City of Bend and Water Resources Planner, Manager, Official Planner, Coordinator.
And I'm Chair again, Patrick Griffiths, Water Resources Coordinator, City of Bend. Thank you for the opportunity to come before the committee today. Yesterday, my observations are it was a great conversation. There was, I think, every stakeholder group represented. I think there was a fresh look at some of the issues that have been in front of this committee before, and I think we captured them in a realistic way that's going to be helpful to make informed policy decisions in the future. So, with that, I'll go ahead and dive into my presentation, if that's okay. I have two handouts coming around to you. One is an article from Water Efficiency Magazine about what Bend is doing on conservation. I won't go into details on that. I'm going to highlight a couple of things. And the second handout I'm giving you today for Bend is an article that was in the OSU Alumni Magazine, the Stater. And I have to say, as a recovering middle school science teacher, there's a feature, a person in this story about watershed restoration and the education and partnership we have with OSU, and it's one of my former students. So I'm very proud of that. I can't take full credit. He's a good kid to begin with, but we spent a lot of time in 7th and 8th grade on Tumalo Creek doing projects, and now he's doing it for a living, and he's got him really engaged in higher education. So that's a win for us. So let's talk about the city of Bend's needs. I wanted to focus a little bit on what we're doing. This is a picture of a water wheel in the Deschutes River in the early 1900s here in Bend. This provided water pressure to fill a reservoir to put out fires. You could not get insurance for your town in the early time without a documented source of water supply. And a little background on Bend. We're about 78,000 people today. We serve about water to 70% of the folks in Bend. We have about 24,000 service connections plus about 4,800 fire hydrants. One-third commercial, two-third residential is the mix that we deal with. Our current water use, we had a peak day this summer of about 28 million gallons. It's a one-day peak. In the wintertime, we're nearing 6 million gallons a day in the winter and average about 18 million gallons a day during the summer. Average annually is about 11 million gallons a day. Critical point I want to make today is we're very lucky to have two sources of water supply. We have surface water supply up on the Bridge Creek drainage and the Tumalo Creek tributary, and we also have about 50% of our annual supply comes from the regional aquifer. And there are a lot of water systems in the state that would give a lot of money to have a dual source system, so we're proud of that, and we want to use that as efficiently as possible.
So the remaining 30% of those individual wells?
Those are actually private water systems. We have Avion, one of the biggest private utilities in the state, and we have a smaller private utility, Roats Water System, that the city of Bend grew around. And so we work collaboratively with those guys to deliver water and partner with them in a lot of different ways. We deliver sewer service to the same customers that these folks deliver water to. So it's a little challenge to coordinate sometimes, but we're working on that issue.
Thank you.
Yeah. But I want to remind this committee and those that forget sometimes we're that first responder. You probably woke up in Bend this morning and the first service you used was water. And I think we every day meet the public health protection needs. We support the economy. We provide that fire protection. And I think we add to the overall quality of life. And I think we've done it so efficiently and so well for so many years that people forget about the infrastructure and the amount of time and money it takes to keep those systems running. Not just Bend. That's all of the West and the U.S. I think they're talking about $1 trillion of investment in infrastructure. As you can see, I like pictures of history. This is a picture, if you've been down to the old mill district lately in Bend, this is what it looked like at the height of the two largest pine mills in Oregon here in Bend. This changed the water quality dramatically. And in 1924, the bulletin in their headline said, Deschutes water not fit for human consumption. We were pulling drinking water for Bend citizens in 1924 out of the Deschutes River. It was done by a private company, Bend Water, Light, and Power. The city of Bend bought that company because they didn't have the capital to go out and look for a new source of supply. We paid $259,000 in 1924 for that water system with about 5,000 connections. And we had to go out and find a new source, and that's when we went up to Bridge Creek. And we've been using that source and adding groundwater to meet our new demands since that time. But as you can tell, 1924 is a long time ago, and that infrastructure is starting to age. We also have inherited an issue that was decided about 100 years ago when the water rights were given out in the basin. This committee, I think, is familiar with the blue whale. I'm not going to belabor it to say that even if we did not add one more person to our basin, these historic flow conditions, we have to deal with them. And so that middle river and that upper river hydrograph change is absolutely something that we're going to have to deal with, whether or not there's any more growth or change in this region. And I just want to remind the committee of that importance. We also know something in the city of Bend that we're not here alone. This is a picture of the first political boundaries that I think is really critical for all of us to understand. These are the irrigation district boundaries. These were put in place before any UGB was decided, before any most of the towns were put in place here. In fact, before the city of Bend was incorporated in 1905. And look what's happened since then. We've added some new political lines onto that map, but we also know that Bend is part of that larger system on the political map as well as on the water map. And so we've been pulling folks together to talk about water issues since I've been at the city of Bend in 2000. This is a map I've come to love and to hate. This is the map from the Oregon Water Resource Department. This is our reality. This map, the shaded area that takes up the predominant part of this map, tells us that there is no water available for new appropriation. And so as a water resource coordinator, this puts fear into my heart when I realize there's no easy way to get water at all in this region. But it's not just the cities. Anybody else has the same challenge. I want to talk a little bit about that. We're expected to look 100 years back to rethink how water uses are being made today and figure out how to do that more efficiently. We also have to look 100 years forward to deal with the climate change issues. If it looks like I need Dramamine sometimes, it's absolutely true. We have to go through a lot. The catalyst today that we're dealing with are regulations on the water quality and water quantity side, as well as land use changes. And then the tools that we're bringing to bear on this are really the ongoing planning, investment in that, and efficiency, and my favorite word lately is infrastructure and reinvestment in that. This is a chart I used with our city council at a recent council meeting. This map, I think, this chart helped our council understand the responsibilities that the city of Bend has to our citizens. We have a responsibility on the top of the matrix there. You see all of the Endangered Species Act, the regulations, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Scenic Waterway Act, and the groundwater mitigation rules are the ones I put on the top. On the left column are the responsibilities of activities that the city of Bend has to give our citizens. Water supply being one near and dear to my heart, we have a brand new stormwater utility in the city of Bend. We also have a very state-of-the-art water reclamation facility. We're looking at reuse there. But road maintenance, land use, and an issue like near pond and sedimentation in that are critical issues for us to deal with. And so how do we fund all that? How do we staff all that? We don't have a lot of money. You may have read the headlines. We've laid off 31 people in the last 6 months. We have 36 unfunded positions right now, or unstaffed positions. We don't have a lot of depth to deal with these issues right now, so we're looking everywhere and anywhere to help. And so what we realized is, as we look down this chart, if we can invest a dollar in the Endangered Species Act, we expect that dollar to also have a benefit in the other acts that we're dealing with. We have to be that efficient with our investment. But that takes some planning and coordination. We understand the traditional approach has been to silo up on all of these acts. And I'll give you an example. The Scenic Waterway Act directly impacts our groundwater appropriations in this basin. And so we have formed this groundwater mitigation rules. The legislature passed that in 2005 with House Bill 3494. But it only takes care of a slice of the issue. It doesn't deal with water quality. It deals with water quantity. And so we have to merge these together somehow, and that's not an easy task. So our approach now within the city is to take a watershed approach and try to integrate this as best we can. We can't do that without help. And I think whether it's a regional approach, a state approach, or a federal approach, we're looking at every avenue to streamline that for better use of dollars and better use of staff time. And so the other thing I'll just leave a concept with you is the cities across the West are the last straw into every watershed. And what I mean by that is we're expected to fix most watersheds when we come in for that last little drop that may or may not be available. And that is an expense that maybe shouldn't be borne by just our ratepayers, because there's an extent of a greater public benefit. We also understand agriculture is often asked to be the provider of any new water, and that may or may not be the right way to go, but we're working with our agricultural partners to decide that. And also, in-stream needs are not often well-defined in any basin, and I think we have recognized in the Deschutes Basin it's the largest new demand that we have to meet before we can really go forward boldly on any economic plans. And so what we are challenged with right now is this allocation process lacks certainty and reliability. And what we're trying to do is align it with this land use process. If we're looked at to bring in land for 20 years, it seems to me we ought to have at least a 20-year window for water as well. And so how do you mesh those two processes within the land use process? It's a big challenge. We're doing it as best we can with the tools that we have, but I think we're going to need some new tools. And then lastly, on this slide, funding is a huge challenge, but I want to give you the next slide as an eye-opener, because it's going to demonstrate how widely and how varied water is valued today. So what I did is a little math. I took an acre-foot volume of water, and I'm going to give you an acre-foot price and actually a gallon price. And you can kind of see the various user groups and stakeholders and how water is paid for today. In our basin today, I took three districts and averaged some prices. I used some of the Deschutes Water Alliance studies. They pay $35 an acre foot to have an acre foot volume of water delivered to a 5-acre parcel. City of Bend, and I just want to assure you, we don't have gold-plated hydrants, but sometimes we feel like that with the water going on. Right now, with our weight increase that was passed on September 1st at $1.19 per 100 cubic feet, that's about 748 gallons, that amount to about $600 an acre foot. But there's a difference here. We deliver potable water, pressurized, 24/7, beck and call. I also want to emphasize to this committee, the cost differential there is not for treatment. The cost differential there is for a 95% efficient delivery system that can last 100 years when it's put in the ground. That's what you're paying for in that. The cost of treatment is pennies in our situation. And I'll talk about that in just a second as well. When you go to the store and buy bottled water and buy a gallon on sale, you're paying $325,000 an acre foot at a dollar a gallon. That's a stunning price, and the public pays that willingly. When you probably get better treated water out of the City Bend system. And lastly, how many have been to a sporting event, been thirsty, and paid $250 for a bottle of water? That's $6.5 million for an acre foot. Now, I'm going to just suggest that people don't know what they're paying for, they don't understand the big picture, and somehow we have to sort this out to help pay for the infrastructure and the other demands that are being placed on utilities and agriculture in this basin. We also have a special characterization under state water law. We have this, what we call a study area in the upper basin. That's that gray shaded area circled in red. Basically, the state came in, we participated in a very robust groundwater study starting in the early 90s, and they made a connection between the surface water in the lower basin and the groundwater we pump in the upper basin. And they said, theoretically, if you pump a gallon of water in the upper basin, it could affect the surface water flows in the lower basin. We don't know what the timing is, but we know that there could be an impact. So the department said, you know what, we're going to put a moratorium on any groundwater appropriation. There was no new groundwater appropriation in our basin in that study area unless you mitigate. And so we've been challenged with that as well. I also want to acknowledge that science changes, values change, and that is causing some of the situations that we have. And I'll tell you, we applied for two new groundwater rights in 1992. And those two groundwater rights for a total of 24 CFS have taken us 16 years, millions and millions of dollars. We went through a water management conservation planning process, the rulemaking to develop that plan. We went through a rulemaking on Division 315 extension rules for some of our other water rights. We had to become fully metered. We had to go through rulemakings on the groundwater mitigation program, a Supreme Court case, and then back to the legislature to get this remedy before we were allowed to get those two permits issued. We're not done yet. The permits have been issued, but now we're challenged with attaining the 3,223 mitigation credits to allow us to pump that water. Now, if there's any good news out of the economy right now and the slowdown in growth is, we don't necessarily need that water today. We still need the credits in order to meet the next wave of population moving to Oregon, and we intend to do that. House Bill 3494 right now, we have a work group put together. We're judiciously going through that program to see its pros and cons. We're working with all of the stakeholders involved in that process. But again, we need certainty. We need to know what our costs are so we can budget and staff to get that done. We are trying to develop Bend as a model utility, but it's not easy. Again, we're using that total water management approach. But I want to just leave you with three projects that we're most proud of right now. We're going to talk a little bit in the next panel about the Deschutes Water Alliance and the water bank we put together. I just mentioned the 3494 work group, but the chair wanted to hear a little bit about our conservation program. And so let me just briefly tell you about some successes there. We have had a very terrific, humorous outreach campaign that the public has really endorsed, and they really liked it. And if you read just the one on the left there, that's one piece of a big campaign. People understand that it's a tough deal to even manage water in your own backyard. But they're responding, and I'll give you some evidence of that. The other, Xeriscaping in the High Desert, is a guidebook that we publish in conjunction with OSU Extension Service. That has been well received. It's won awards all over the place, and that has become a standard in Oregon for a lot of other municipalities and areas to work on the landscape piece of water use, which is absolutely the biggest use of water in a lot of municipalities and water providers. We're very proud of that partnership, by the way, with OSU. The WaterWise program, we've won some awards. Here's what we're focusing on today. We installed a new hydrant program, which means all of the water that used to come out of hydrants, we didn't recover a lot of money for that. and it went to development and a lot of other things, dust control. And what we decided was we needed to do a better job of protecting those hydrants because we didn't know who was operating them. We didn't know if that hydrant was working or not. The fire department was very concerned, and that program is now not only a revenue source for us, but we're able to meter and measure that water and put backflow protection on it at the same time. The other thing we're doing is refining our rate categories. We used to have just one rate category. Remember, we used to be flat rate and unmetered, and everybody paid the same rate and used unlimited amount of water. We're happy to be metered now because we actually get a lot better data, but we need to continue to refine that. Collecting data is expensive, and it takes a lot of coordination with your finance and the rest of your utility group, and we're doing that. The Safe Drinking Water Program is now part of the WaterWise program as well. That is protecting our drinking water. If we're going to spend a lot of money to put clean, cold, clear water into the pipes, we better protect it once it gets there. And that's, again, state regulations through the Cross Connection Program and Division of Health. Stormwater. They have a new program. It's called It's All Connected. We're going to partner with them to do more of this type of work because the messages are the same. If we're efficient in water use on properties and don't have dry water storm runoff and we're managing our construction sites, we're going to meet our stormwater permit requirements as well as meet our conservation program developments. And here's the program that I'm most excited about. We could produce a lot of Class A reuse water, but it doesn't make much sense to pipe it 8 miles uphill back to Bend. I'll tell you right now, we don't have the money to maintain a single pipe system. To put a dual pipe system in Bend and pay that energy cost to pump it up here doesn't make a lot of sense. But what we do have is an irrigation district canal that runs 500 yards next to our wastewater treatment plant. Why can't we work out a reuse swap agreement with those guys, work through the permitting, and find out how we can lead more water into the chutes and give them some Class A treated water to use in their irrigation district? I think that's something we can work out, and we're looking into that. Lastly, we're going to update our water management conservation plan. That's moving ahead. Our first 5-year update's coming up. But we understand, based on your energy talk this morning, the carbon footprint and the water footprint are directly connected, and we're working on that in a lot of different fronts. And let's talk about that. Even our tagline really respects the fact that water is connected to so many things. And once you pay attention to water, you are working on a lot of other issues. This is the graph that I think we have to take some pride in. We were growing at 1,000 customers a year for several years. We have not increased our annual amount of water. Once we got fully metered and engaged in the kind of programs that we engaged in, you can actually see our water use has flattened out, and we're very proud of that statistic. But we don't have a lack of challenges in other areas. We are facing 3 critical issues right now in our surface water system. We're looking at about a $50 million solution. We hope to bring that number down, but it's too early to tell right now. That aging infrastructure I talked about, we have an 11-mile pipeline up to Bridge Creek. That is 80-plus years old. We're seeing signs of it failing with root infiltration and other issues. New regulations, the federal government EPA LT2 rules, are forcing us to treat that pristine water for cryptosporidium. We don't know what that's going to cost, but we want to make sure that we comply when those rules do come in. And then the third risk we have is we have about 40 to 60% standing dead timber in our watershed. We know it's a matter of time before the fire hits, and we want to avoid the risk of not being able to use 50% of our surface water supply, and that's a tough challenge. We hiked with the new forest supervisor last Friday. We had a terrific discussion with them. They're going to come up with some modeling, but we know that if we do this particular project, we can package this together and maybe have a benefit that gives us a sustainable supply for the next 100 years. But remember, if that benefit accrues past our ratepayers, we're going to be looking for Betsy grants and ETO, Energy Trust of Oregon, Senate Bill 1069, Renewable Energy, and other federal and state investment to help us pay for that, because I think the benefit's going to accrue in the middle of the chutes, the lower of the chutes, and others where that water can flow. And so as we look at that, we want to look at it with a 100-year set of eyeballs. Lastly, you've heard a little bit probably before, we'll hear it more in today's discussion in the afternoon about the ESA being reintroduced due to the Pelton Agreement. The cities and counties are partnered up now, and we're looking at the activities that we share, the ones on that graph earlier. We have a lot in common with the other cities and counties in Central Oregon, and we've come together, we formed a risk assessment team, and we've hired the scopes of work are in, and we're doing the study, and we'll be able to review all of these activities and see if we're meeting our obligations under the ESA so that we're not exposed with any undue risk for lawsuits or other issues on a taking. And so that is going to be a 6 to 8 month process. And again, it really paints the fact that we're working on multiple fronts, trying to be as collaborative as we can. But again, we've got a challenge to do that cost effectively and efficiently. And so we see a little bit of uphill ahead, but I think we've got some good partners in the basin. We can continue to talk about that. The last slide I'll show you is, again, my history piece. It illustrates a little bit of change. The guy in the wagon there used to deliver water to your home or business back then. Does anybody see a water quality problem there? I think there's a lot of changes going on. But again, we have a goal of a sustainable water supply, and it's much easier said than done. With that, I'll close, and I thank you again for your attention.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Any quick questions? And I will say that we'll be in the tour this afternoon, so I know if you want to have some in-depth discussions. And thank you also for your help as a co-sponsor on the water forum yesterday, helping with that work.
Yeah, the Central Oregon Cities was glad to help out, and I think we'll all benefit from the information we gathered yesterday, so thank you again.
Thank you. So I just want to give an update. We have about, I'm going to say about half an hour left. We'll probably go over a few minutes. We're going to spend the rest of the time talking about the South Deschutes County water management issue. I know there are some folks here who would like to make some public comment. If you do, there's a sheet. Is it by the door? Where's the sheet? So if you do, could you please sign up on that sheet so we have a sense of who would like to. We're going to have 2 to 3 minutes testimony each. If anybody would like to, there's a sheet over by the door. We'd like to ask you to sign up so we know if anybody here would like to provide public testimony. The next panel, I'm going to call everybody up together. Mike Kaczynski from the Department of Environmental Quality, Doug White from the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and Peter Kutowski from Deschutes County. And gentlemen, we have about five. I'm sorry, I'll ask you to be efficient, about 5 minutes each, and then we'll have time for questions and people can come in after that. Who would like to start?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Kaczynski, and I manage the on-site septic system program for the Department of Environmental Quality.
So we may have to pull the mic a little closer so the folks in back can hear you.
Madam Chair, committee members, representatives, my name is Doug White, for the record. I'm a community services specialist for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I also work specifically with Statewide County Bill 11 for the sewer and water issues in rural areas.
Madam Chair and representatives, my name is Peter Kutowski. I'm a principal planner for the Deschutes County Community Development Department, and I manage the long-range planning section.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate you being here. And wanted to get an update on the mainly focusing on water quality issues in the middle part of the Deschutes and in the Pine area. I know I've heard concerns about it and lots of questions, and I think it would be perfect to get an update on what's happening from all of the different agencies that are hopefully working closely together to resolve this problem.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This morning, we're going to be talking about the wastewater management in South Deschutes County, and specifically the effects of septic systems on the groundwater quality in that area, and what progress has been made to address them. Please feel free to ask questions at any time during the presentation, and between the three of us, we should be able to answer those questions. So what are the concerns? Well, studies and sampling as far back as 1979 in South Deschutes County have shown isolated problems areas for nitrate contamination in groundwater. And nitrate contamination is a concern because children less than 6 months old who consume water with high levels of nitrate are at risk for methane bleed anemia, or bee baby syndrome, which is a condition where the nitrate can ultimately interfere with oxygen carrying capacity in the child's blood. Also, nitrate levels in drinking water can be an indicator of the overall water quality because nitrate is water-soluble and moves easily in the water. Elevated nitrate levels may suggest the possible presence of other contaminants, such as disease-causing organisms, pesticides, or other inorganic and organic compounds that could also cause health problems. U.S. EPA has established 10 parts per million as the maximum allowable nitrate contamination or concentration in drinking water for public water systems. And state law sets nitrate concentration of 7 parts per million in groundwater as the level at which regulatory action must be taken to control water quality degradation. So why are we concern about septic systems. And there's a six-page fact sheet from the U.S. Geological Survey that does a pretty good job of explaining why. But the reasons include that the groundwater table is shallow. It's about 20 feet below the land surface, and it seasonally rises to within 2 feet of the land surface in some of the low-lying areas. The area has sandy soils, which allow rapid infiltration of septic system effluent to the water table. The amount of precipitation that enters the aquifer is small, which limits the dilution of the septic system effluent. There are also more than 9,300 residential lots, most of which were platted in the late 60s and early 70s, that now use or will use individual septic systems for wastewater disposal and shallow wells for their water supply. And over half of these lots are less than 1 acre in size, making residential densities relatively high for an area where homes are dependent on individual septic systems and wells. At least half of the existing drinking water wells draw their water from shallow sand and gravel deposits within 50 feet of the land surface. And septic systems are the major source of nitrate contamination in the area. There's a little agriculture down there, and there are a few golf courses, but both of these potential sources were eliminated from the list of concerns monitoring did not show them as major contributors. So what has been done so far? After the studies and sampling conducted in 1979 and 1982 documented nitrate contamination in drinking water wells in what was known as the Lapine Core area, which is now the city of Lapine, a community sewer system was required to remedy contamination in that area. There are also other community sewer systems in the area, such as Sun River and Oregon Water Wonderland 1 and 2. However, much of the area is still served by conventional septic systems, including sand filter and pressure distribution systems, which are not designed to reduce nitrogen. In 1988, a regional problem-solving project involving the community, DEQ, DLCD, and Deschutes County began identifying additional solutions to the problem. The results of the project included a recommendation to develop a geographic rule to address nitrate contamination from septic systems. In 1999, EPA funded the Lapine National On-Site Demonstration Project, and the four main tasks of this project were to field test nitrogen-reducing septic systems, develop a septic system maintenance structure, perform groundwater investigations to develop a model to be used to assist in determining the fate and transport of nitrate, and to establish a loan program to replace or upgrade existing septic systems. That project was completed in 2005, and findings of the project have been used to allow more innovative systems to be used statewide to establish maintenance requirements for certain septic systems and to establish certification requirements for septic system installers and maintenance providers. In addition, the findings of the project have been used to establish nitrogen reduction requirements for septic systems in South Deschutes County. In 2002, Deschutes County created a transfer development credit program that was designed to reduce the number of on-site systems in the area and transfer that potential development to an area that was served by community sewer and water systems. This program allowed rural property owners in the area to sell their right to development into a newly established subdivision known as the Neighborhood Planning Area, and that is served by the City of Lapine Sewer System. The program was later amended to change the focus to a pollution reduction credit program that required upgrading or retrofitting existing systems to create credits required for development inside of that Neighborhood Planning Area. DEQ's on-site program at the time did not have, and they don't have now, adequate resources to develop a geographic rule. So in June of 2005, DEQ supported Deschutes County in establishing a local ordinance that would require nitrogen reduction standards for septic systems in the area. DEQ acknowledged that if development continued at its current rate using the same septic system technologies that have been used in the past, we will see broad impacts to the groundwater over time, and that something must be done to address the problem. We really supported the proactive approach to solving the problem now instead of dealing with a much worse problem in the future. In early 2008, the Deschutes County Board of Commissioners convened an advisory committee to provide recommendations for a financial assistance program to help residents of South Deschutes County offset the costs for upgrading or retrofitting their systems. The recommendations have been made, and the board is currently evaluating those recommendations to determine how to proceed with the financial assistance program. And in addition to that financial assistance program, Deschutes County is drafting a legislative proposal regarding tax credits for upgrading septic systems. And as you can imagine, this was a contentious issue that resulted in many public hearings held by both Deschutes County and the South Deschutes County Citizens Action Group, which was primarily formed as they were the primary organization opposed to that ordinance. The Bend Bulletin covered numerous stories on the issue over the past few years, as well as local TV and radio stations. The reasons for opposition to the ordinance stated by those who opposed it included that there really wasn't a problem with nitrate or nitrate contamination, and that the county was using scare tactics. The local ordinance did not take into account the development rights of red lots, which are lots where groundwater is suspected to come to within 24 inches of the ground surface, and the lack of expanding the use of cluster or community systems, and the county's unwillingness to consider any exceptions to statewide planning goal 11. Some other reasons for opposition include the lack of community involvement in the resolution of the issue, limited time to review the reports and modeling that supported the county's proposal, and the desire to have DEQ take over the process to establish a geographic rule rather than a county ordinance. So to address all of those issues that were raised, we have taken a closer look at the science behind that nitrate loading management model, which is another, that's the other map, the other handout that's there. And we did that with the U.S. Geological Survey and did conclude that it was a good predictive tool to determine how to proactively address the problem. We've also coordinated with PLCD and Deschutes County on additional public outreach and extension of the public comment period to allow more time for community involvement.
Jenna, thank you for that. We've got about 7 minutes left to go for you guys.
Okay. And you talked before, thank you, Madam Chair, we spoke before about many questions that came up could be answered by all three of us.
Well, it's just one of those questions that we
Thank you, Chair. This red lot work program is currently underway, looking at the implications of development of these red lots. DEQ, Deschutes County is also working on updating the comprehensive plan. And the latest developments are that the Deschutes County Board of County Commissioners, on July 23, 2008, adopted the ordinance, which becomes effective on October 23, 2008. And the basic requirements of the new ordinance would require the use of nitrogen-reducing systems for all new construction and major repairs and alterations, and the upgrade of all existing systems by November of 2022. On August 7, 2008, a petition for a writ of review and request for declaratory relief from the ordinance was filed in Deschutes County. Of course, we're likely going to be involved in that case. And the Deschutes County, they received a notice of a potential tort claim. So there's a lot of sensitive issues around this. And I can't go into too much detail about that, but happy to answer any questions that you may have.
And so I'm just going to ask that you can just bring up on this from a perspective and maybe the people, folks from the
Madam Chair, my name is Doug White, Department of Conservation Development. One piece of information in response to the concerns raised, I think, is one of the things is it's very complicated, it's very involved, it's a planning process, a land use process, annexation into a sewer district, formation of a sewer district, very, very complicated and time consuming, takes a lot of work. So DEQ, DLCD, and Deschutes County have created a detailed packet of instructions, flowcharts, and a compilation of all applicable requirements to provide interested neighborhoods and special districts detailed information on the process to establish or extend sewer or install nitrogen-reducing systems. Interested citizens have the opportunity to meet with the responsible managing agencies, in this case it's the three BLCD, county, and DEQ, and they get a chance to meet with those folks early on to discuss their interests, what they'd like to see their community to look like in terms of sewer on site, and they get a chance to meet with the agencies that are going to be responsible for that process early in the process. So what we described the front end load this process heavily. And we warned them that we want to give you everything you can think of that's possible that you need to be aware of, and then it'll help them get through the process. Because sometimes the land use process and the district process, annexation formation, they need to go simultaneously, and you need to be aware of each process because they're very involved and involves fiscal issues. So, like I said, we've been very careful and we want to give everybody as much information as they have up front so they know what they're and we've had several meetings with neighborhoods and communities and districts that are interested. And sure, there's concerns and stuff about the regulation procedure, but I think we've done what we could under the current system to make it as user-friendly and really try and get the citizens and the folks out there as much information as true as we can. And you get to meet with the folks who are going to be involved later on up front, kind of like a one-stop that we can use in the model. So we think it's working pretty well.
Madam Chair, I just want to make two quick points, knowing that, I'm Peter Gutowski. I'm a land use planner for the Deschutes County Community Development Department, and I want to make two quick points. One is, as Mike Kaczynski pointed out, that the USGS developed a nitrogen loading management model that demonstrated that groundwater quality could be protected if new and existing development relied on denitrifying technology. And so the map that you have in front of you that has two shades of green with white as a background is demonstrating that groundwater quality can be protected over the long term, meeting the state's groundwater protection standard of 7 parts per million when all future development treats nitrates at the highest standard available, the best available technology. And what you're seeing there in green and in white is what existing development has to treat based on variable standards. Which raises the second point, is that the adoption of the local rule is not an unfunded mandate. There are several county programs and resources that are going to be made available to existing residents, and I don't have a lot of time to go into that, but I wanted to just raise your attention to one thing, which was highlighted by Mike Kaczynski, is that Deschutes County has been working with DEQ on a tax credit when that if it was adopted by the legislature would create tax incentive for when people convert a conventional septic system to an alternative treatment system. And this morning, Dave Kanner, to my left, the county administrator, if there's opportunity, would like to just brief this committee on the status of that formulation of a tax credit. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this really excellent update, and we have Commissioner Luke and County Administrator Tanner, and if you can also identify yourself for the record, I appreciate you coming.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Deschutes County Commissioner Dennis.
I'm Dave Kanner, County Administrator for Deschutes County.
And the tax credit's the biggest part, so I'll let Mr. Kanner go first, if that's all right.
I'm not sure what more I can add to what you've already heard. We are working with the governor's office, with DEQ, with a number of other people in Salem to create tax credit legislation. And one of the things that I don't believe was mentioned in the testimony that you just heard is that DEQ has already made a determination of an existing health hazard in South Deschutes County under OAR 660, so we do feel that we have an obligation to try and help people there financially. The money that Deschutes County has available to put toward this problem will not be enough to completely fund all the work that's going to need to be done, and because there's a partnership between the county and the state, we certainly would expect hope for some state participation in financial assistance, and I think one of the easiest ways the state can do that is through a tax credit for those people who upgrade their on-site septic systems or connect to a sewer system. At this point, the legislation is in a purely conceptual stage. We are trying to get something drafted, but I did want to let you know that you can expect to see something in the 2009 session regarding a tax credit for not just South County, but for anywhere in the state where DEQ has made a determination of an existing health hazard due to contamination from on-site septic systems.
If I might add, one of the reasons for the declaration, one is because we believe there is a health hazard down there, and two, it allows the development of sewers outside urban areas. It eases that process, and it will be very helpful as we work with our citizens down there to develop sewer. Matter of fact, Sun River is looking at expanding their sewer system and moving their plant, and they instituted a community meeting with people outside of Sun River, and over 50 people showed up for this initial meeting about converting and maybe hooking up to the Sun River sewer, which sewer is by far the best solution to this, but if you can't get sewer, then the other one is there. The county also, I was a state representative in the mid-90s, and I remember going to meetings back then. The county ended up buying property down there. And the proceeds from that property and the proceeds from the tax pollution credits that we get down there go into a fund to help people make these conversions. We estimate how much? 34?
Between $30 and $35 million, Madam Chair.
Will be available to, and that money will be dedicated to helping the residents down there. And the Central Oregon Housing Authority also has money available for low-income people to help with their septic. So that the tax credit isn't the whole thing that will pay for it. It's just another step that helps people make that conversion. And this is a proactive stance. It's not, we're not waiting until you hit the pollution level that you got to shut everything off down there. This is a proactive stance so you don't. And the final thing is, the study has shown that the city of Bend talked about and everybody else, is eventually that groundwater hits the rivers and everything is downstream from South County.
Well, first of all, I just want to thank you for joining me today and for your hard work and for everybody's commitment to the city in a very tough situation. And just so you didn't think it's only in your area, I represent districts within the city of Portland and also have separate city neighborhood parks. And I came into being during annexation and changes from the Portland County and the city annex areas in Portland County. Anyway, the city of Lake Park is accepted. We've been surrounded by the city of Portland and facing the same issue. We were looking at $30,000 per household to hit that conversion to hookup. We don't have the same issues necessarily with the monetary, but it's a concern because we have water coming down the Columbia and the city of Portland is under the system for one. So it's not unique to sewer areas. So I appreciate all the hard work you've done and taking us forward for the cooperation. So we certainly do everything that we can. I know there are not enough resources to do all this, and certainly I'm sure it'll be the right thing to protect the water quality and the people. So any questions for the gentleman? Because I feel like since he's down scooping gas from down through the room.
Just a quick question. This tax credit idea, which is a great idea, is that part of the current maintenance cost of these new systems? What's going on with the conversion of initial construction?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, as we envision it, and we haven't had a lot of in-depth discussion about it, as I said, it's purely conceptual, but as we envision it, this would only be to help with the capital improvement costs and not with the ongoing maintenance costs.
Final comment. We really appreciate you bringing the committee coming over here, and we've had other ones here, and this room is always available to any legislative committee, and we appreciate your taking the time to come.
Well, thank you. We'll be looking forward to working with you in the session and the discussion. So you know that there's going to be basic and supplemental challenges and priorities to go and make it all to Justice Collins, and it's not just the theory of the state. It's the need of the state to be so much more. So we appreciate especially the hard work that you've done with the town.
Thank you.
We have one more public comment before we're going to take a break and move on to the second part, which will be a tour. Is Jan Lee, who's asked to come up and provide some input. Welcome. And some of you may know that Jan is also a former legislator. We have a former legislator here today in the Clackamas area. And if you could identify yourself.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Jan Lee, and one of my major roles is Executive Director of the Northwest Hydro Association. We represent utilities and developers, irrigation districts, and other folks, not only in the four Northwest states, but also Northern California. And I wanted to commend you on the work you've done to develop funding through Betsy and the Energy Trust. Those are important programs here in Oregon that other states like Washington are pretty jealous of. There are about 15 potential projects that consider either piping or existing reservoirs here in Oregon. Most of them are at existing diversions where there's already fishery protection, et cetera. And we would like to see those developed over the near future and included in the renewable energy mix. I'm doing some work here locally for Swale Irrigation District, and they've benefited from both the Betsy Credit and ETO, but we've had some considerable problems getting through the ODO loan program, in that that program was originally designed to fund projects based on hydro revenue, and now the department is looking at requiring other collateral in addition to that. So we'd like to have some information. Maybe the committee could take a look at that program and see if there is a way to make it more effective for all the people who have to be involved in that program to fund their projects. And I do agree that the emergency board putting more staff on is a great idea, because we had to wait 7 months to get our Betsy credit, and we've been in the ODO process for a year and a half, still with nothing on the horizon except a potential March bond sale. So we hope that'll go through. I also wanted to say that economic development is a major benefit from these projects. Here with the piping projects that Swale and COID have, contractors are going to be able to be put to work who are currently on hold because of, as you know, the downfall in the housing market. And the last thing I'd like to say is that Deschutes County has been very innovative in putting together an ordinance that allows these kind of use of existing facilities, hydro projects, that makes them an outright use. And I think that if we had a statewide model ordinance, we could get some more promotion of these kinds of projects. So I would suggest that ODO might also look at that as a tool that they could offer to folks. And thank you very much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for those excellent suggestions, and I appreciate it, since you've been on the ground for it. And we certainly are aware that there's more demand than we can meet right now, and
right.
Trying to do that with our community resources, but certainly we want to make sure and get this competition on the ground. The longer we take to get another one, the cost will go up, and the expenses. Any questions for
small scale energy loan program? Famous five special sessions.
See you there with us suffering, a few of us that are left to feel that pain. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you. I just didn't want you to forget small hydro, which has been around 5,200 years. That's the point.
Thank you. And with that, we're going to adjourn. Unless there's anybody else who would like to come up and make a public comment? Yeah, could you come up to the microphone and please identify yourself for the record?
Well, thank you for listening. My name is Robert Ray. I'm president of the Citizens Action Group, and I was also the chairman of the Financial Advisory Committee that addressed the funds that are going to be available for the nitrate reduction systems in Lapine. One of the problems that we foresee is that the $35 million that are projected have no oversight on what future Board of County Commissioners are going to be able to do with it. There's no guarantee that that $35 million, projected $35 million, is going to be earmarked for exclusively for the use of helping the people in 70.
issues, Ken, with the problem of the nitrates. And we've never said that there is no problem down there, but we do believe that the situation is localized. And the model is just a model. There has been no empirical data showing that the model is in fact true. It's like a weather report. It's thrown out there. They have something that they've seen and it works, but there's no empirical data at this point to show that the model is actually true. There has been comments that tests are going to be made in 2010, but at this point there's no funding's been identified to take those tests, and all we want to do is ensure that the model is in fact true and correct. And at this point, there is no empirical data to show that. The map that you have here, a little terrifying when you look at it, but this map is from the year 2139. It's not in the next 10 years. 2139. So it doesn't say anywhere in here, but it certainly terrifies you when you see it. As far as the political process and whether we were allowed to really put anything into this legislation, if it hadn't been for three angry housewives, this never would have started. And they grabbed the tiger by the tail when they did that. So for 24 months, Citizens Action Group has been fighting Deschutes County to at least be heard, and they have listened to us, and the financial advisory group was able to give them suggestions, and I hope that they have taken some of those ideas under their fold. But it is a localized problem, I think. It's not been proven that it's going to cover the entire area, and I think it was done in the entire area just to make it simple. And I think that even DEQ regs say that it has to be a case-by-case or a lot-by-lot or situation-by-situation test. And we think that Deschutes County has overstepped their bounds in requiring everybody to do this without looking at each area individually. One of the areas for the closest test well is 3 miles to it. So they don't have any data really from that area. And even in the USGS report, they say that they have no idea what the riparian area is going to do to nitrates as it gets closer to the river. They do not have any idea until DEQ does their TMDL study, which is mandated by 2010. So it's just they've gone too far, too fast. And again, all the $35 million is for land sales, and it's not going to happen anytime soon. I think we can all agree on that.
I thank you for sharing your comments and concerns here today. And I do want to apologize that we weren't able to get into the Deschutes River TMDL process, but that will be a future meeting. But I appreciate your comments. And I think it's good that lots of people here heard that.
We could go on and on. We could go in 24 months, and it's going to continue.
Obviously, it's been a long, complicated process, but I hope that certainly any legislation that we will consider, there will be input and opportunity for public input. And I know that you think the representative for the areas and what representatives are listening. And so make sure that the comments get passed on to him as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else wants to come up? Okay, with that, we will adjourn the House Energy and Environment Committee.